going to use nice, loud teacher voices. And if it's a problem for anyone to hear, let us know, and we'll figure out a way of pulling the mic over.
So you move that one over, and Sheila can share mine?
Yeah, move
that one over.
Our microphones.
Yeah, we just don't have a microphone.
Yes.
It's down here.
We just don't have
the
wireless mic. We have one at the podium, and that is for our
We can stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are there agenda deletions, additions, or changes of sequence?
I have a deletion.
Okay.
Sorry, I got lost here. I would like to pull
Okay.
And I'd just like to make a change to agenda item 8.3.5. There was a revision to a document, and the footer was only changed on a few of the first three pages to 3.8. The entire document's footers need to be changed to 3.8, and we will do that formally, but it's just to make sure that the full document accurately reflects the modification.
And then that's actually two documents, and it occurs eligible classified employees 14, 15, and 15.
Okay, and superintendent's remarks prior to public comment?
Done.
Okay, time for public comment. These are for presentations of matters that are not on the agenda. We welcome the public. Due to the legal constraints of the Brown Act, your trustees are not allowed to comment on public comment, but we're happy you're here, and we invite anybody to speak that would like to.
There's no point in using this.
Yes,
no, it works.
If you turn it on.
I just want to... To remind you that there are a lot of people that are still waiting to find out exactly what the district is going to do with Natural Bridges School. Yes, I am nagging or something. It'd be a problem for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
In front of you tonight is a special invitation to our California Thursday kickoff event at Harbor High School, March 17th. We will be featuring California food for California kids. California Thursdays is based on a simple premise. California students will be served freshly prepared California grown foods. 58 innovative school districts, us included, across the state have joined the California Thursday Network. We are committed to feeding our students freshly prepared meals that are delicious and locally sourced. On our Collective Action Day, March 17th, we will celebrate how much we can accomplish together as a network. By offering more than 1.5 million students the opportunity for California food. It is a win-win proposition. Healthy students are better learners. Local purchases help our local economy. And we do our part for the environment. Please join us on March 17th in the statewide celebration of California food and in our district every Thursday by your participation in our school lunch program. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Any other comments? Okay, superintendent report.
Good evening. On Monday night, Jim, Angela, and I had an opportunity to meet with parent leaders from across the district at our first PTA central office booster ELAC president meeting. We didn't have full representation, but it was a start, and we brainstormed ideas to make sure that we get more folks there the next time we meet. We talked about budget, LCAP, facilities, and potential collaboration on other issues. we did some plan. We're planning on a biannual formal meeting, but we're looking at some collaboration on facilities needs this spring, in addition to the meeting that we had on Monday night. So it was a good start, lots of good ideas, lots of great questions, and appreciated an opportunity to meet with our parent leaders. I wanted to note, I should have started with this, Jim is on vacation this week. It's never a good time for your CBO to take time off, and we told him he finally needed to take a few days. So he's on vacation this week, and we welcome Kyle Rucker, our new interim director of finance. I'm going to ask him to stand. And he's going to be filling in and doing Jim's report tonight. We welcome Kyle. He's jumped right in, full on into the pool, and is swimming full speed with us and keeping us on top of all the things we need to be on top of and answering questions, and it's been a great addition. This week we had both the ARC and Santa Cruz High School WASC visits. We want to thank both the ARC and Santa Cruz High School staff for their work on their WASC self-studies, and they were successful visits that will guide next steps in collaborative continuous improvement for kids. On Friday morning, I met with Thomas Gelder and Christine I'm mispronouncing this name, and I have to pause for a second. Onjoko, and I apologize, I need to hear things a couple times before I get right. From the Everett program at UCSC, this was Trustee Coonerty connected me with them. Really exciting program that they're running, and I was able to learn about the YEI College Mentor Program. They are working with girls who are first-generation college-bound with a summer camp. They have a grant, and they're teaching girls to code during the summer. And it's also a leadership program that gets first-generation college-bound students ready for college. And last summer, they made this amazing app that is about helping, and it's, you know, they can get it on Android and get it on Apple, but to help kids do their college planning and preparation, and it's a lot of good information, and I'm going to be connecting them with our counselors and with the Santa Cruz County College Commitment, because I think S4C could be a really great sponsor for them and a way to make sure that the word gets out about their program so that more kids get access and that more kids can use the tools that they're developing. So it was an exciting meeting. I met with PCS President Connie Smith last week. She's the new board president, and outgoing president Pete Rode facilitated the introduction. We discussed our current facilities agreement and collaboration, and I was appreciated the opportunity to meet her as Pete was formally transitioning out. We Molly and her team have been conducting needs assessments for the new principal positions. We have three principal openings for the 16-17 school year. She's been meeting with the Bayview Harbor and Santa Cruz High School communities to get input on the qualities and the skills that different stakeholder groups want to see in their next school leaders. The positions are open, interview panels have been identified, and we're really grateful to be early on in the hiring process. This last Saturday, I was able to spend the morning with the Tier 2 administrative class here at the County Office of Education. It was an opportunity for me to meet some of the up-and-coming leaders in the county and spend some time with them and share a little bit about our district. Today, Eileen and I met with Chief Vogel to continue our work on refining our SRO MOU. Our attorney was with us, and we walked through the last MOU that we have was dated
2006.
Yeah, 2006. So we were just updating it, re-clarifying roles. We made some agreements today, tweaked the draft, and we'll bring back a second draft for conversation, but it's good collaboration. I also was invited this week by City Manager Martine Bernal to a meeting at the end of this month with UCSC and the city to talk about faculty housing. And I appreciate them including me in that conversation as we continue to explore how we might pursue a faculty housing project for our school district. And that's it for this evening.
Thanks, Chris. Board member reports.
Just want to let everybody know tomorrow night at 6:30 at Harbor High, the Santa Cruz County School Boards Association will be meeting, and our guest is, I should have told you this, CSBA President Chris Unger, who's coming up to talk to us about adequacy and funding and the privacy issue for student information. And we'll also talk about the Legislative Day of Action, which is next Tuesday, the 15th in Sacramento.
Can you say the time again?
6:30 p.m. at Harbor High, most likely in the library.
I am going to talk at length about the Educator Effectiveness Funding Grant because it's item 3.8.3.12 on the agenda, and I'd like to talk about it now.
Jeremy, can you wait until the item comes up?
There'll be no one here. It's at the end.
I'll be here.
You want to move it up?
We could move it up. I would be happy to wait, sure.
Okay. So can we so we'll do a change of sequence and move it to the maybe right after the what's that? Yes. After 8.3.1?
Before the safety plans.
Before the safety plans? I mean, then we would have the opportunity to discuss rather than just have a presentation.
I was hoping to speak about it and have people maybe think about it for a few minutes, but I guess it's 6-1, half a dozen or the other.
8.3.
Well, you know, we can speak about it if one wants to speak about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, sure.
So we'll be moving it to follow the...
let's do it first.
Okay.
Let's do it right after the first item.
Right after the first item. Mm-hmm. Right after the trauma-informed schools training. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Patty, do you have a board report?
Oh, are we on there?
I would just like to congratulate the Santa Cruz High boys basketball team, who in 15 minutes will be continuing their CCS playoff and have tip-off. So, it's really exciting when a team is together for this long, and I'm always, excited is, I guess, the word of the evening for me, excited to hear years to come. The championship team from 20 years ago still talks and calls each other, and it's a big part of the secondary piece in athletics, and so congratulations to Santa Cruz High boys basketball.
Yeah. I've been talking with parents who have incoming kindergartners and transitional kindergartners, and they've been attending the open houses, really impressed with our schools, and really excited about the additional class at Monarch. So that's been fun, and I'm looking forward to the California Thursday event. I'm going to be there. I hope other people join us. I think we're going to have tacos, right?
California tacos.
That's my report.
I have very little to report tonight, but just in case no one knew this, the judge rescinded the request for all the data of all the students, which was a pretty great thing. They got, the judge said, overwhelmed. I'm really happy to hear that they were overwhelmed by requests to not have it happen. And I am unfortunately going to miss the California Thursdays because it's St. Patrick's Day. Somebody not Irish thought of that one. But it's also my brother's 70th birthday, so I'm hosting about 70 people at my house. God help me. That has nothing to do with being on the school board, but that's just gossip. Okay, that's all.
So I wasn't able to attend, but I heard a report about the Calciano Symposium, and I just want to commend Eileen Brown for her advocacy and facilitating a strong showing of administrators. I heard that we had a great turnout. The Calciano Symposium focuses on different things related to mental health, and this year it was about focused on transgender issues. And so I was just very pleased to hear that we had so many people in the audience. And one of our Santa Cruz City Schools parents, Dr. Jen Hastings, was one of the presenters. I also want to congratulate Harbor High teacher Ron Indra. for the prestigious Trailblazer Award by the Diversity Center for his advocacy and his participation as the director of the small schools, I mean the Safe Schools program. It's an honor, and we are lucky to have Ron as an advocate for our students. I attended the District Marketing Committee and the Sentinel Editorial Board meeting with Chris and Molly, and it was sort of fun to think about how to present our district and show off the great things that are happening here, and also to share with the Sentinel Editorial Board some of the challenges we face in meeting our goals. And then finally, I attended the first meeting of the inaugural meeting of the Harbor High Beautification Committee, inspired by Patty's monthly reports and Santa Cruz High's. We decided to go ahead and launch one at Harbor High. We're not going to do it every month, but we're going to do it 3 or 4 times a year and really try to build community and support the school and make things look nice at Harbor High. And that's it for me.
Bring my tools.
I'll be letting everybody know when the first one is. Okay, so first, the next item is approval of the minutes for the regular meeting on February 24th.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Just say aye all together. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay, 7-0. And it's time for the consent agenda. The consent agenda is for matters considered non-controversial that can be passed in one roll call motion. Are there any items on the consent agenda that people would like to have pulled for discussion? Mm-hmm. So then, are there any questions on the from the board on consent agenda items?
I would actually like to pull one for discussion. I wasn't fast enough.
Okay, go ahead. Which one?
The Clifford Moss one, and I would just like some information about it.
Okay, can you give me the number?
Yes. 8.1.7.2.1.
Okay, so we're pulling that. And is there any public comment on items that are on the consent agenda?
Yes, I have. Before your tenure on the board, there had been previous controversies around this particular class within the classified ranks, which is listed there, although they're not classified employees. This is under the current professional expert. And in doing the math from looking at this choreographer, not to exceed 300 hours, and then given the dates, that is 8 hours a day for 38 days.
Would you say that again, Robert?
As you were told earlier that was an error, that I should have mentioned it was a stipend, not
correct.
Hours. Mm-hmm. So, Nancy, you can correct that. That is.
I'm sorry, tell me again, what is the correction?
Stipend versus 300 hours.
For which?
So the stipend is $300 versus
correct.
300 hours?
Yes.
Oh, it's a $300 stipend.
Yes.
Okay.
Can you give us the item number?
It's 8.1.2.
So this is...
they weren't sure. They didn't
oh, this is in the personnel classified action?
Yes, professional.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so we're making a change to reflect that it's a stipend, not hours. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, Molly, that will be your department that will make the change after your CSA, okay? Okay, great.
The CSA is correct. It wasn't right on this.
Oh, so it's just a matter of reporting it in the document.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so consent agenda. Do we have a motion?
I move approval. Second.
This is a roll call.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. And now it's time for reports of actions taken in.
Sorry.
8.1.7.2.1. Go ahead, Sheila.
Oh, just what I said. I wanted a more public description of what we were doing in terms of Clifford Moss and why this is showing up here.
Would you speak up, please?
Okay, so...
Sure.
I'm sorry, it might feel weird to you all that I'm using this really big voice up here, but the goal is that everybody can hear me over there, so I'm not intending to yell at anyone. We did an RFP process. We had an extensive process last spring where we worked to identify campaign consultants for what we knew would be two consecutive years of campaigning, potentially. The board has to make a decision about whether we go for a bond or not, but we're exploring that possibility. And we interviewed several vendors last spring. We had a successful campaign in the fall. As with anything, we always have feedback for our vendors, and we're giving feedback to our vendors based on what we had last, you know, but our work together this fall. But I feel comfortable and confident for us as a district moving forward to retain Clifford Moss to advise us on the potential facilities bond for the district in the fall. We'll need to do polling, we'll need to gather information that would help inform a decision by the board. We had a successful poll. Our results in the campaign this last fall almost exactly mirrored the polling results that we had last spring. So we feel confident moving forward with them.
Can I just ask a second question, Chris? The involvement of the business community is usually great in bonds. Mm-hmm. Is that something that Clifford Moss is going to be doing, or is something we're going to be doing?
Well, it'd be a collaboration between Clifford Moss and us. Uh-huh. And we really benefited from having Bill Teisling on our campaign steering committee. He's the head of the director of the Chamber of Commerce, has become an ally and supporter of our district, and he served as our treasurer in the OMP campaign. And we are next, I should have put this on my report, I'll report on it next time we meet, but next Wednesday we're going to have a table at the Chamber event, as we've become more active in the Chamber and local Rotary as a cabinet team, to make sure that we're building connections with the local business community and listening to the leaders in business and other community sectors to inform and connect with us as leaders in education, and recognizing the interdependence of a successful schools and a vital, vibrant economy.
Thank you.
Are there any comments from the public?
Move approval.
Okay.
Second.
Ray was the first chair.
Okay, so roll call.
Aye.
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 Aye. Now it's time to report on closed session.
The Board of Trustees took action on certificated, classified, and management leaves, retirements, resignations, and appointments. The Board of Trustees heard information on expulsion 10-15-16. The Board of Trustees heard an update from Assistant Superintendent Molly Parks regarding SCCCE negotiations. And the Board of Trustees heard an update from Assistant Superintendent Molly Parks regarding GSCFT negotiations. The Board of Trustees heard information regarding a public employee performance evaluation.
And Sheila, do we have gifts?
Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. I forgot to look.
We don't have any.
We don't have
no.
any.
We're good.
Oh, good.
No.
I didn't forget to look.
Not good.
No, not good.
We usually have gifts. So it's time to vote on expulsion 10-15-16. Is there a motion to adopt the recommended decisions for the student?
I move approval to expel student 10-15-16 through the end of the first semester of the 2016-17 school year, and to refer the student to a program within the County Office of Education.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. And 8.3.1. Turn it over to Angela.
So I'd like to welcome our Director of Student Services, Eileen Brown, on her way up to the podium. I want to
take a moment to just thank her. She's going to be introducing this report tonight, but and passing it over to some of the teachers and administrators who have been working with trauma-informed schools. But Eileen, through her leadership, brought this resource to our district in a very invitational way. And I would say you're going to hear tonight from her and from the schools. But that impact is beginning to spread beyond the schools. So I'll turn it over to Eileen, but I just wanted to take a moment to thank her for her leadership.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure to bring this training into our schools. Trauma-informed services has been really sweeping our county for about 7 years now. We first contracted to bring some information to our school counselors and assistant principals. We have since learned more and more about the power of this work in the classroom. So this year we wanted to bring it directly to our teachers. We spent a little bit of time, actually we spent a lot of time working with our consultant, because she hadn't really done a whole lot of work in schools, and we really had to do a lot of adjusting for what does this work look like in schools as opposed to a community-based agency. And I think that we were able to work with our teacher leaders, our principals, and move in that direction. So these are the three areas that we look at when we're looking at our safe school climate. This is what we're always trying to impact. And with this trauma-informed schools, we're moving more and more in that direction. Really understanding that, unless we really understand brain development, it's difficult to work with students. It's difficult to work with youth. And we have learned so much recently about brain development with all the research on how the brain develops. It's not just hormones when you're an adolescent, it's actually your brain structures that are changing. And so we really need to adapt our teaching to the brain that students are coming with. One of the most important parts of the trauma-informed work is really understanding that students may be behaving in different ways in school, and it not necessarily mean that they're defiant or they're oppositional. It often has to do with the long-term childhood trauma that they've experienced, and recognizing that can really help us as staff members respond to those students in a helpful way, rather than in a punitive way or removing students from the classroom, and that might not be the solution to helping them adapt and have the opportunity to learn. So we really spent time in this training understanding that trauma can show up in many different ways. And there are things that we can do to help students so they can stay in the classroom, stay learning, and we as adults don't have to take that behavior personally. I'm going to turn it over to Kristen. So in this training, I'm sorry, because I wasn't expecting this slide. I'll just talk for a minute. I just want to read some of the objectives that we have, and it might be the slides will show up later. These were the objectives. We went in really wanting to measure the impact of this training. So we wanted to look at office discipline referrals, and we expect those to decrease in the two schools that we worked with this year. So I talked with you in the fall. We had done a training with all the counselors, all the assistant principals, and teacher leaders. Then we continued the training at B40 Middle School and the small school's campus through the teacher leaders presenting at their staff meetings in the fall. Then in January, we did a holiday training for all of their staff. So we did some front loading. We realized that it would be helpful if they had some information before they showed up for an all day, you know, kill your brain with lots of information. So we did some front loading. So that day in January was useful, and we actually had some time to dive a little deeper. So in these two schools, we want to measure a decrease in office discipline referrals. We expect to see an increase in attendance, both for staff and students. We expect to see a decrease in incidences of defiance and disruption, and a decrease in student removal or self-removal. So either the teacher is asking the student to leave the class, or the student is just leaving the class, because we expect that their needs are going to be better met. We expect to see an increase in grades and also credit completion. And we want to do that because we expect this training to help us improve students' self-regulation skills and our own self-regulation skills. We expect it to help improve classroom perseverance skills, and we expect it to help support the staff care with their own coping skills. We trained 72 staff members in January, 90 in August. We expect to impact approximately 900 students at the two schools that are served directly. The cost of the training to date has been $7,500, and I don't expect that we're going to have any more costs for the year.
Thank you. So we're going to talk briefly about two things, adverse childhood experiences and trauma and how that affects the brain and how it affects learning. And one of the important things, we often think of trauma as a specific incident or a series of incidences, but really trauma that has long-term effect is trauma combined with not having coping skills. So I don't know how many of you woke up the other night to horrendous thunder, and in my neighborhood, the car alarms went off, and the first thing I thought was, where are my children? Like, I immediately went back to the earthquake, and where are my kids, who were very little? And then my brain was like, oh, I know what this is. So that's the kind of thing that trauma affects, and kids who stay in trauma for a long time can stay in that area of the brain where they're not thinking about cognitive things. The ACEs study, or Adverse Childhood Experiences, actually occurred back in the 50s when a doctor who was working with significantly obese patients and finding that they just were dropping out of his program, even though they were successfully losing weight, decided to follow up with all the dropouts and ask them lots and lots of questions. And from this, he discovered this preponderance of childhood experiences that was occurring in the vast, vast majority of these patients. He was surprised when he presented this information to a group of psychologists who just said, no, that has nothing to do with why people are overweight, it's just because they don't have willpower. So someone in the audience came up and said, you need a larger study. So they went to Kaiser, who was studying 15,000 people at the time, and added on all these questions about whether or not people had these experiences, and found that 62% of adults did have at least one of these, and about 17% had four or more. And keep in mind, these were Kaiser patients in the 50s, therefore mostly white and mostly middle class. So the rates are even higher when you look at different groups. What they then found was that there was a significant rate of increased chronic diseases, and then when these studies were followed further, they found significant effects on education, that students who have had lots of trauma in their life are less successful in school, more likely to be expelled, more likely to drop out, do poor academically. And so that has sort of led to the brain research of why does that happen? And I'm going to let Lisa talk about that.
So as Eileen said, there's a lot of brain research that's come out recently in the last few years. A lot of you are probably aware of some of it. The neurosequential model, which is based on the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, who also did a lot of work, who connects the brain to the way trauma impacts it. Part of what's really important about this is it's not just about trauma in the brain, it's how your brain works and how you learn best. So this has huge impact when you look at kids who've experienced trauma, but it actually has impact on all of us and knowing how your brain works to learn best. So I don't know if you guys can all see the slide, but I will use my hand, which Michelle will also show you a way to use later. So there's three main parts of your brain. This part down here, which is the brain stem, deals with self-regulation, fight, flight, or flight. That's where you go. Hunger, basic things. We call it your reptilian brain often. This part of your brain, which is your limbic system, has to do with more social interaction, language, interacting with other people. And the top part, which I'm going to forget the name of because I'm in front of you, the cortex, I think, so this would be social, kind of mammalian brain. This is what we call the human part of the brain, because that's where abstract thinking. This is the part of the brain where we want school to happen all the time. We want kids to be up here thinking abstractly, using critical thinking skills and all of that. But the way your brain really works is you have to go back and forth, cycle back and forth between these three parts. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. kids who've experienced a lot of trauma often don't have a lot of self-regulation coping skills to help them when they're triggered somehow, and they go back to this brainstem part of their brain. So the neurosequential model in a classroom, what's important for a teacher to know, is that kids need to be grounded, and the teachers are going to talk to you about some of the things that they've done around that. When you're planning lessons, there has to be some kind of grounding time, there has to be some kind of social interaction, and then there has to be an opportunity to go up and use that super abstract, critical thinking part of your brain. But you can't go up there and stay there. Even right now, while you're looking at me, unbeknownst to you, you're self-regulating, because how adults do it is, you move your eyes, you jiggle your foot, you take a deep breath, you reset your brain so that you can go back to the abstract thinking part of your brain. And so learning about that, how your brain works for teachers, is kind of an invaluable thing, because you're trying to affect people's brain development. If you don't know how the organ you're trying to affect works, that would be super hard. So that's a big piece of what we did in this training. And the last thing, just to kind of give you one last little piece, the self-regulation part, that's where you would be listening to music. The relational limbic system, that's where you'd be playing music with someone else. And the abstract part is where you'd be composing music. So I hope that gives you a little idea how the brain works.
Take it away, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle. So I'm a teacher at Monarch. And so, you know, as important it is for we teachers to know about how the brain develops, we believe it's also important for the students to know about the parts of their brain and how they work and why that helps them work. So this is just a little, I'll show you this, little activity that we did with our post-Denova High School Buddy class. It's a model of the brain. And so you'll notice, like what Lisa said before, that when the person is feeling calm and in control, that the calm, thinking, critical part is intact. But when that goes off, then this inner brain is exposed. And the kids are realizing that. And when you're really exposed, oh my God, the little monster comes out and he's right there in the middle of the hand, which is like the brainstem. I wanted to share with you tonight some of the strategies that we've been teaching in our classrooms through class meetings or sometimes just the morning check-in meeting. So there are a list of 89 safe coping skills that you can use in any situation. And so I went through the big list and found several that I thought would be accessible to my students. So we've been practicing working on different using grounding strategies. So mental grounding, physical grounding, and emotional grounding. And so here are some things that I asked my students. So what grounding strategies or what coping strategies do you use on a regular basis? And then how does that make you feel? Or what does that do for you? So a third grade boy says, I take deep breaths. It helps me concentrate and relax. Second grade girl said, I take a little break. I read. I drink water. It gets my mind refocused. Third grade boy said, I count to 10. That's a kind of mental grounding, Michelle. It helps me figure out what to do next. A girl said, I think of a safe place. It brings safe feelings to my body. A little boy said, I fiddle with my fingers or a squeezy thing. And I concentrate on something other than the negativity, or you could say that, like being scared or nervous. A girl said, I visualize a safe place. She goes, that's mental grounding, Michelle. A first grader said that he likes to do squats and push-ups when he's feeling angry, and that helps his body helps him breathe again. And we've been talking a little bit about the vagal nerve, that is a nerve that resets the entire nervous system. Another girl said that she thinks about why she's mad and decides if it's really worth it. This part of her brain is still intact if she can do that. Another child said, sometimes I write down what's bothering me, and I crumple it up, and I put it in the trash, and it's done. It's just gone. Another boy said, I like to touch water. When I'm really mad, I get really hot, and it cools me down. And I thought that was a really self-aware thing for this seven-year-old to say.
Hi, I'm Kristen Cameron, and I work at Rainier.
Grant Sporting Middle School. I'm a new sixth grade teacher there this year. Well, not new. I've been working as a teacher for 9 years, but I'm new to Grant Sporting Middle School and really fortunate to work with the staff there. I know, it's so interesting. You get up in front of the school board and all of a sudden my body is flooded with cortisol. So I'm going through my own safe coping skills and planting my feet and taking my deep breath, trying to make sure I'm not talking too fast. And I just wanted to share with you some of the things that we've been doing with middle schoolers at B4. In my own classroom, I have a particularly rambunctious core class that meets in the afternoons, and they all come running in, and they're sweaty and exhausted and flushed right after lunch. And when I came back from my trauma-informed services training, I was like, all right, we're going to do some grounding. And so I said, all right, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to think of a scale from 1 to 10 in your head. And 1 is, I'm here, Ms. Cameron, I am settled, and I am ready to learn. And 10 is it time to go yet? Or 10 is also, right? And so I said, think of your number in your head. You don't need to share your number. And then I happened to look around the room. And I'm fortunate to work in a very colorful classroom. I work in a room at B40, so lots of color. And I said, can you look around the room? Can you please count 4 things that are red? Now can you find 3 things that are green? Now can you find 2 things that are orange? Now I want you to find 1 thing that's blue and focus on that. Then I ask them to take their palms, press them into the desk, feel with their fingers, feel with the palm of their hand, and feel with their whole hand on the table. And then I start asking them some questions. In your head, imagine your favorite food. In your head, imagine your favorite animal. This weekend, what's 1 fun thing that you're going to do that you're really looking forward to? Now I want you to picture your favorite place. What does it look like? What does it smell like? What sounds are there? Who's there with you? And I watch their energy go from up on the ceiling, and you can visibly feel it in the classroom. It's almost like you're watching a meter. And all of a sudden, you could hear a pin drop in the room. And then I ask them, so think about that scale from 1 to 10. Did any of you have a number that came down? If you'd like to share, you can raise your hand. Did any of you have a number that stayed the same? If you'd like to share, you can raise your hand. Did any of you have a number that went up? And I never get a hand that says I have a number that went up because we just did this exercise. So this is something I got to share with our staff. We also do a lot of grounding where their eyes are on me and we're following and doing some kind of physical grounding kind of activity. And I love it because most recently we're studying Egypt, so this has become part of the motion. I was talking to a colleague who's a math teacher, and a lot of students, of course, have math-related anxiety. And she said that she recently started using the Tarot Up method, particularly right before she gives assessments. And so she was able to have students write down, what's your biggest fear? What's your worry about this test? What's the worst thing that could happen? Write it on this paper. And then she walked around with the trash can, they all ripped it up, they took some deep breaths, and then they took their test. I talked to another teacher who's teaching, who recently taught The Outsiders, and she gave her students a writing prompt that involved the safe coping skills. So she talked about them in her class before, and she said, now, let's look at Pony Boy's choice. And if you were Pony Boy, what safe coping skills would you recommend that he use? So what I see at Grant Sporting Middle School is that trauma-informed services is not only being used in the classroom, but it's also having an impact on the curriculum that we're building, and it's allowing students to connect to the curriculum in a whole new personal kind of way. Thanks.
Excellent.
So I think we started in the district 7 years ago thinking about how can we use this in the disciplinary process? How can our assistant principals understand how to ground students first before they try to engage in a conversation in a really high-stakes discipline situation? And then the more we learned, the more we were able to get ourselves to trainings. And Bruce Perry's website, Dr. Bruce Perry, is just as wonderful website filled with applications. We were able to understand this is something all our teachers will need, and you've just heard not only using some of these strategies to help kids calm down, and actually building it right into the curriculum. So kids will be seeing throughout their curriculum. Our next step, we hope, is to bring this to more schools. So we managed 2 schools this year. That seemed reasonable. I think that we probably can just about do this on our own now. I'm not sure we need a consultant anymore. We've really educated ourselves. We've adapted it for schools. So our next step is to bring this to more staff at more schools.
Are there questions from the board?
Is this questions or comments?
Questions. Are there any questions? Are there questions or comments from the public?
I'm not part of this Mutton crew, by the way. This is my own. I just wanted to share that I was lucky enough to work with In my years as a teacher, and I was lucky enough to teach in Santa Cruz County, but lucky enough to work with kids who really needed a lot of support. And a lot of that came not from a training necessarily, it's just by the experience of supporting kids. I was very happy to see that here when I worked at B40 as an assistant principal, I was given the opportunity to learn more about the background and the science behind it. So what used to be to do this on a gut instinct, actually, there was a lot of research behind that that worked. So I really want to encourage our board to think about how to support our students that way, and at the same time, thank you for the opportunities and for the training that you can make possible for us. I know I grew a lot as an administrator after I received some training around trauma informed. And it was quite great to see our students respond positively to it.
Any other comments from the public? Okay, comments or questions from the board? Jeremy.
Yeah, I have a question for Kristen. Cameron. Yeah. Hi, Chris. But, yeah. So I think that's really exceptional what you're doing. So what you're saying, if I'm hearing this correctly, so you're studying a text, let's say The Outsiders, and you're looking at a character who's about to mess up, perhaps commit a violent act or a senseless act. And then what you're doing, if I'm hearing you right, is you're saying, what might this character have done differently that we're learning ourselves to do differently, thus connecting the text to their own immediate experience.
And the idea that they're facing choices every single day, and some of them are facing really difficult choices. And so by going over these safe coping skills with them in a way and asking them to apply it to a character that's outside of themselves, not only are they reviewing those coping skills one more time, but they're also able to put a little distance between themselves and those skills, right? Well, I would tell him that he should do this. Well, right. Why did you choose that one?
Right.
So that's been something really, really powerful as far as embedding it in curriculum.
I understand this lends itself most easily, perhaps, or most naturally to language arts curriculum, but I would suggest that it lends itself very well to social science as well. In other
Absolutely.
Words, why does a country or a leader
Absolutely.
Do that? And I'm wondering, do you have examples of
No,
seriously.
No, seriously.
I mean, we're looking at, Egypt or something.
Interestingly, right now, Egypt is exactly where the 6th grade teen is.
Right.
And this year, we do an ancient Egypt museum because our focus is ancient civilizations. However, this year, in doing planning with David Dorman and Sue Moen, we are bringing into our unit on Egypt connections to what's happening in modern-day Egypt. With a particular focus on the conflict that's occurred there within the past several years. And so this is another way that we can bring trauma-informed services into the classroom for our students in examining the problems that countries have with one another and within themselves. And a big part of our focus in regards to ancient civilizations is government. We've been recently asking the students, how do you govern well? How do you maintain peace and order in society? And it's another way that we can touch on trauma-informed services in the classroom.
And a very, very quick follow-up question is about how it seemed
like this happens fairly quickly, like within a few minutes, these processes that you're describing to settle the students down take place.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Sheila.
Well, I was just sitting here thinking that pretty soon I'm not going to have a career if you guys keep this up. what I really liked was the specifics in your presentation. It really gave me a great sense of what you're doing, and I hope you are spreading it fast. and I was imagining getting a bus and going to each new place where there's going to be a primary and trying to calm everybody down before they go in and vote. Sounds like a good idea. But really, thank you. I think it's a great thing. And I have just one question, which just came to my mind, so that's why I didn't ask before. Do you show the students how to do it, or do you explain to them, as you were to us, the how it works?
On each campus, I think we're working with how it works, and also explaining to them like what's going on with your brain. So I think the more transparency, the better. It's kind of the attitude in regards to the trauma-informed services. And we're not telling kids, like, hey, you guys are probably walking through the door of trauma. We're talking about, hey, sometimes we all experience stress, or we face a situation where we have to make a choice in a moment, and here are some things that we can be doing. Here are some things that we can do to self-regulate. So making those processes in the body and in the brain more transparent and more available for students to reflect upon, I think is one of the biggest goals of the trauma-informed services kind of model.
We do explicitly teach the strategies like imagine a safe place. Mm-hmm. We take time to do that. And almost like a guided meditation for the first time. Mm-hmm. But then you can help the kids get back to that place really easily by just in the environment you create in your classroom. But, yeah. And then we do role plays of what is a situation where you might use physical grounding. Like, is it appropriate to do a bunch of jumping jacks in the middle of class if you're feeling stressed out? Like, no. So then you might want to make a choice about using an emotional grounding strategy, like thinking in your safe place. Or counting a mental grounding, like counting. We practice counting the slats on the blinds. So trying to help kids be able to we're explicitly teaching what are appropriate coping strategies in particular situations. And this is like 5-year-olds are able to do that and able to articulate why they're doing that. Yeah, it's a combination, and then you need to look at it in a developmentally appropriate way as well. So like we're doing less literature connection, but we're doing it more in part of a social-emotional curriculum, and working in a lots of partner way. Another way that we apply the neurosequential model is that when we're writing lessons in elementary, we will always try to start a lesson with something physical, like maybe going like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, you know, something like this, and then have a partner talk, so just one to one, and then maybe a little group share before we do a whole mm-hmm. class share before we go do the big cognitive, collaborative, creative work. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to take the kids through each of those levels of mm-hmm. their brain and return, continue the cycle of refocus and re-regulation.
To kind of tag on with sixth graders, helping them self-regulate is enormous for them in the classroom, right? They come in and they're often, oh my gosh, I don't have a pencil, and I need to tell everyone, and I need to yell to the teacher that I don't have my pencil. So we're taking this idea of the daily check-in and scheduling, and we're applying it to, all right, you guys, let's talk about a scale from 1 to 5. 1 being, I don't have a pencil. We're probably going to be okay. 5 being, oh dear goodness, teacher, the ceiling is caving in and you're not noticing we need to exit the classroom. And of course they have a good giggle over it. They're like, well, that's just silly, Miss Cameron. I'm like, I know, but when you're running around screaming like, my pencil, oh God, I lost it, where is it? I can't find it. You're a trauma or some stress for fellow students. So helping them kind of self-regulate and like, is this a one or is this a five? So particularly these things like scaling and this and any kind of physical thing that we can be doing with them is really definitely helpful. So thank you guys again for your time.
We're not done.
Dee Dee. You somewhat anticipated my question. It was about sort of the developmental adjustments that you made for a kindergartner versus a middle school student. So I want to take you to that upper level of development. How is this being implemented at the high school level differently than it would be at the middle schools and elementary schools?
I don't think it is that different. So Costanoa and Monarch both use positive discipline, which is very connected to the trauma-informed model. And so actually that little hand that Michelle passed around was a Costanoa-Monarch project jointly. The kids and the little kids did it together. So they learned the same thing about, probably in more detail about what the parts of the brain are and how they interact. The teachers are teaching the same coping skills. They both use class meetings, so during class meetings is a good time to talk about grounding. I haven't heard back from anybody about making the kind of curriculum connections yet that Kristen's making in middle school, but this is also brand new to everybody, so I don't think our expectation is that it's integrated into everything yet. When was it? January when we did the all day? But there, now that I heard the outsider's story, I know that that's a book that's being used across the world, and that would be another way to bring that back. So as we continue to move forward, there's a leadership group at each of our sites that has done, and these guys are on the meeting, who've done a little bit more training than bringing that to the rest of the staff, and that's something that we're planning to continue. So we have another meeting coming up in March where the two teams are going to talk about how do we support the rest of the staff and continuing to bring this into integration in the curriculum and other parts of the classroom. So does that kind of answer your question? I don't think it looks super different. I think there's a lot more probably curriculum connections that you can make at a different level than you do, developmentally. So.
I'll just add that it also works with adults. So part of the original training that Jose did and that I did had to do with some key phrases to use, like, it makes sense that you got really angry and yelled at your teacher when you felt embarrassed in front of the class by, a comment that was made or something like that. And then there's a whole sort of series of responses. I've used that a lot with parents that come in and are really upset. I've used it occasionally with teachers that are really upset. I might have even used it with my partner. So it's, the strategies work at all ages because we all get angry.
And just to piggyback on that, Michelle reminded me that our staff meeting today, we actually, not super intentionally, used the neurosequential model. So we were talking about a new topic in a PLC. First, everybody wrote about it, which would be going to your sort of quiet, ground yourself place. They shared with a partner, they shared in a trio, they shared in a whole group. And then from that, we went to the most highest abstract level of conversation about the same topic. So hopefully, during that, people are also cycling back to re-ground themselves. But as adults, we don't build that into everything we do all the time. But it's really the same kind of steps that you
need. We didn't have to process the whole thing for hours. Like, we kind of processed it already through that process, so we could just get straight to the, well, what are we going to do about this issue? We're going to apply this issue. It was really cool.
And I think one thing that I'm looking forward to is bringing this training up to our high schools. One of the connections that we really see is with Common Core, the early emphasis on working as a group. And that may not be a natural place for a lot of kids to work. So the idea that you have to really address that need for a student to be grounded, maybe to work on themselves first before they're going to be ready to engage with another person. And kids who have a lot of trauma and are always in that heightened, anxious brain really need that. So to bring that into the classroom as you're really thinking about how the layout of your lesson is something that I think could really impact the success in the high schools of really the Common Core and the implementation of it.
Jeremy?
I'm sorry, I didn't see it. Got to put it.
Just a
I wanted to thank you. I think this was a wonderful presentation. I loved hearing the stories and the examples of what you're doing in the classroom. It's a topic that I'm really interested in. I've taught infant toddler brain development at Cabrillo College, and what you were saying about adults is so true. I watched those adult students have those aha moments and start to understand why they're feeling the way they feel sometimes, and then the being able to handle those feelings is so important. So thank you for the work that you're doing.
Sorry about that, Claudia. Jeremy?
Now I have a Chris question. So I was observing in a different role Sarah Goldfarb's 8th grade class, and she does a 5 or 4 day unit on the brain and stress. And I thought, when you were presenting, how interesting, because of course, this then gets to the academic side of things. And I was wondering, my first question was, and I do have one after this, is that intentional as a tie-in at an older grade to the sort of stuff you're doing at 6th and 7th? Or was that coincidental?
That started 2 years ago when we were looking at critical reading strategies and what types of articles we want to choose. And we chose that because we were sort of beginning to explore this idea, and we were knowing that kids are under a lot of stress, and that's affecting us, and that's affecting their ability to learn. And at that time, we didn't have these strategies, but we started to talk about it. So that, I think 6th grade has done some stuff with growth mindset, and so different articles that we're choosing as we're working on our critical reading strategies.
And my final point is just a suggestion that we, in the educational world, talk so much about intellectual or academic intelligence, but perhaps because it's squishy and it has a liquid center, it's a pathless land, so to speak. We don't talk a lot about emotional intelligence, but I do think it's something that we can begin to construct some systems around. And so that kids can have a vocabulary about it, and so that when that girl or boy is screaming about a pencil or a shoe that's untied or a bad hair day or you know, a ripped shirt, we can begin to have a language to talk to them about that's appropriate at grade level. I really think it would be a great gift for all of our kids, many of whom may excel academically and just not have a clue in this other realm. So thank you so much. Really.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to go to 8.3.12, the Educator Effectiveness Grant. And Angela, are you going to start with that?
I'm going to take a moment before we get our PowerPoint going to ground ourselves in both the honor and the responsibility around receiving grants and then making recommendations. And I think it's something for us to ponder for a moment that we haven't had that opportunity really until the last few years to look at how do we expend money that comes our way, and unfortunately it seems to come our way in these one-time offerings, and to recognize the impact on us personally, that in the leadership role that we inhabit, that there's a tremendous responsibility to look at that funding as potentially having a huge impact. And we draw upon our experience, we draw upon the knowledge that we have, but we also have to acknowledge that we may not be cognizant of all of the needs. So we have to, I think it falls in this cycle of examining how do we effectively surface all of the needs, how do we look at those needs, not only through our lens, our experience. So I can look at it through my lens as a elementary principal, middle school principal, teacher, but also acknowledge that there are other perspectives, other needs. So what I'd like to share with you tonight, and bringing this back for a second review and then with a recommendation to approve, is some of the context that we can capture
At the same time, I want to acknowledge that there are unmet needs, and it's really, just as it's our responsibility to make recommendations, it's also our responsibility to acknowledge that there are additional needs, and how do we keep those needs in circulation so that when there are other funding sources, those can rise to the top as well. As educational leaders, we are responsible for not only responding to and eliciting the voice of the community, we're responsible to monitor our student outcomes. And that has become easier with our data systems with multiple points of assessment. At the same time, it's become a huge challenge because we have so much data and we're really still developing our systems for analyzing that data. And along with student outcomes, I think we really have a responsibility to connect those outcomes we see with the students to teacher workplace, to are we supporting teachers? Are we helping them in their professional development? Are we helping them with both content and the instructional shifts? And I think those are really closely connected. So I just wanted to take a moment and ground us in that. And again, this is our second week through, and so I'm gonna be sharing with you some of the context that we carry when we bring these recommendations forward. Oh, I always go down and see something. There we go. So the educator effect of this funding grant, it's not really a grant. It's money that came one time. I met with Trustee Schodick, and he reminded me, this is not something we applied for. It's something that we received by virtue of being a district in California. And the funds that we received were based on our ABA. So we received more funds in secondary. Than in elementary, and it's one-time money that must be spent by June 2018. And there are a couple of ways that we can use those funds. We can provide new teacher support. We can also provide support for experienced teachers, and that's an area of need that we've heard identified throughout our district, that once you've had your 2 years of beginning teacher support, you may encounter new curriculum, a new situation. You may get kind of stalled in your own professional development. So having resources to help those teachers and to retain them and help them develop. With Common Core State Standards, this money can also go to support that. And we've adopted standards in math and English language arts. We're going to be adopting standards in social studies in the fall. And we've also adopted standards in next generation science standards in 2013. And then finally, it's a really intriguing one. It's training on teacher mentoring and coaching. And this acknowledges that not only do teachers need support, but the person who is doing the teacher mentoring needs support. So it's kind of that, I don't know if that's a meta, but it's the thinking about how do you, coaching the coach, and these are all really, really important ways to support student outcomes. So we're gonna look at a couple of sources of data, and I'm gonna start with the one around teacher support, because this is a really big area right now that I know Molly and our principals are working closely with, and that is how do we recruit and retain math teachers? And when we look at the first numbers are total FTE, so 30.37 math teachers in our district. And the average years of teaching is not a lot, 13.21. I think Molly shared with us last year that over half of our teachers are 55 or over, so we can infer from this that our math teachers don't have the same number of years of experience. We have 5.6 temporary teachers. We have this year 5.43 who are resigning or retiring. And last year we had a bump, but last year we had 15 teachers who were hired, many of them after June, some in August. And of those new hires, 6 of them are working without a credential. So I know I'm sharing this with you as a snapshot of our district, and then Molly will share with you also that it's not just our district, it's across the state. We're really grappling with how do we recruit our math teachers and how do we keep them, how do we retain them. Related to that is our student outcome, and I'm going to take us to the end and then all the way back to the beginning. So through our connection with S4C, we have some data on the students who graduate who are accepted into college, the percentage that go into college, who assess into college-ready math. And so when we talk about students meeting the A through G requirement, that's a big component. But we also need to think of not just four-year plans. We need to be pushing ourselves to think of six-year plans. So once our students graduate, make it into CSUMB, 66% of our students in the county are going into CSUMB below college ready in mathematics. And what that can look like for them is taking classes that are not giving them the credit that they deserve, cycling through basic skills classes. And the same is true at Cabrillo, where 80% of incoming students are not assessing in with that transfer ready level in mathematics. And so this is concerning for us because we're not, as much as we are focused on the experience of students while they're here, we know that our mission is to prepare them for beyond secondary school. For UCSC, a much greater percentage are assessing in as ready for pre-calculus, so 16% of our students, this is kind of an inverted statistic, so 16% are coming in as not pre-calculus ready, so 84% are coming in as ready. But again, the majority of our students who are underrepresented in post-secondary are going to a two-year or a CSU, and that's really where we want to focus our efforts. So going back into K-12, we had our second year with the CASP, and this was the first year that these assessments, we looked at them as this is our starting point, this is our jumping off point. And when we look at those scores, we did better, even though those are not great scores. We did better than many schools in our county. We did pretty well throughout the state. But if we were to drill down into those statistics, what we would see is a gap of 20% or more. So when I look at third grade, for example, and we see third grade through fifth grade, 46% of our students are performing proficient on the state assessment for math. I'll see 70% of our white students performing proficient and 28 to 30% of our Latino students. So clearly, we overall have some work to do with all of our students, and then we have some very serious work to do with supporting closing the gap. We see that continued 6th through 8th grade, 47% of our students scoring proficient, and there's a gap there as well. And then in 11th grade, we see a big drop. And this is a concern for us because we know that there are students who take algebra more than 1 year, that they get to the point where they finally passed algebra, and then they stop taking math. Spring of their 11th grade year, they are hoping that they can apply to a CSU, but the level of math that they've had where they've been successful is not enough to allow them to pass that early assessment. So 14% of our 11th graders are meeting that level of proficiency. In next generation science standards, I don't have any depressing data to share with you because we are not yet assessing, but we do have a sense of urgency here as well. Those standards were adopted in 2013, and we have a little bit of time, but what we're learning from our experience with both ELA and math is that we need to use that time to build a professional development model that includes trainer of trainers, and that is exactly what we have in place. So while we won't be giving the assessment for another year, the past 2 years we've been developing a model where with Heather's in the Heather has shared with us a model of professional development where you train a team and then that team goes and trains another team. And what's exciting about this is that this could become systemic. This could be professional development that we aren't needing to plug the big dollars towards it years from now, that we would have developed a cadre of teachers who really understand those instructional shifts. And so this is another area of focus for us, is really getting this off the ground and supporting our science teachers with what are not only new content standards, but new instructional ways of working with students. In addition to those two needs, we have a plethora of other professional learning needs. So this fall, we will have a new framework for social studies. And what's kind of frustrating right now is our social studies teachers have books that are falling apart. And I think I made a joke about the Berlin Wall last time, but I'm not sure that that, I actually was teaching the year that the Berlin Wall came down, and it was a very exciting moment. So we have old textbooks, and it's frustrating because our teachers need something to teach with, and yet the framework won't be fully adopted until the fall. We do expect, when it's adopted in the fall, that we're going to have more resources and we're going to have more opportunities to bring our teachers together. Technology is huge. We convened a group of teachers and administrators last week and began our implementation plan. And while the system we have right now is really geared towards data and assessment, what we heard from teachers is, how can we use technology to really to better deliver curriculum? How can we use technology to really engage our students? And we heard that across all content areas. And so that's our hope, is that this implementation plan will not simply be building assessments and pulling out reports, but that through Illuminate, we will be able to get information, that we will be able to use that information to really create engaging lesson plans for our students. And we have our ELD, English Language Development Standards, which are very different, really focused on the social functions of language. This is another big area of need, and I think similar to math, moving away from, in math, we're moving away from algorithms, from prescriptive teaching, to how do you use language in different contexts, and how do you use language with a sense of purpose? We continue to need support with English, and in terms of all of our content areas, with an eye towards college and career readiness. So although the funds that are allocated for the Educator Effectiveness Grant seem big, we know that very quickly that can be spent down. And what we're proposing to do is to dedicate those funds towards development of Common Core in math and in science, both in elementary and in secondary, for both of those content areas, to support technology integration in all content areas, so not just through Illuminate. Illuminate can be the way that we get information about our students' levels, but then using our tech coach to bring technology more into the classroom. That we have tremendous need in the area of retaining teachers. So looking at bringing in a PAR coach to support those experienced teachers who maybe need a little bit of coaching outside of an evaluation cycle, who need that side-by-side collegial support. So we have a lot of professional learning needs, and our hope is that as we are adopting new curricula, that we will continue to have new sources of funding. But we're bringing to you tonight a recommendation that you have seen in your board packet.
Questions from the board? Jeremy.
So I like to pass out, if people don't have what I do, Deanne, to pass out before Nancy. And I did make some copies for members of the audience if they'd like.
No, I got it.
First of all, I'd like to thank Angela for a really excellent presentation that I wish we would have heard last time. And secondly, I want to also say how pleased and proud I am as a board member of the fine work that we've done. So what I'm about to read to you in no way is a criticism of the district office or of this school board. However, if you'll bear with me, during our last board governance meeting on January 27th, 2016, the board put a new system in place regarding the process by which we spend money available to us after the first interim report. This system will ensure that in future years our decision-making process will be as open and inclusive as possible. And I think we're pretty unanimous in saying that's good. You know, we've got a process in place there. So tonight the board is presented with another fiduciary challenge, how to spend $572,000 during 16, 17, and 17, 18. This new money that has come to every district in the state, as Angela points out, under the title of Educator Effectiveness Funding Grant, can be spent on a wide variety of programs, as Angela points out. At the time of our last school board meeting on February 24th, when the grant spending plan was presented to the board by the district office, it is probable, I think highly likely, that less than 5% of our certificated employees knew that this money was available. This is hardly an open and inclusive process. How can teachers and administrators be expected to present their opinions on how this money is to be spent if they don't even know that it is available? Tonight, the school board is being asked to make a final decision on this money. I'm very respectfully proposing an alternate plan, one that meets the openness and inclusive criteria similar to the process that the board so wisely adopted for spending first interim report money just 6 short weeks ago. This process involves 4 steps over the course of our 4 school board meetings. Step 1, announce that you have the money, establish a committee, establish a timeline to spend it, let people know how they can contact this committee. Step 2, at the end of the time period for the committee to hear from all interested parties, the committee makes a presentation to the board listens, the board makes suggestions, the committee goes back. Step 3, first reading. Step 4, we vote on it. New page. There's one item in the district's plan that I would agree to spend money on at tonight's school board meeting, and that is the peer assistance and review teacher for 1 year only, an expenditure of $65,000. I'm merely halving the $130,000. I believe that a strong case can be made that by approving this one budget item tonight, the board can prevent an unnecessary layoff in the weeks ahead, and the timeliness of this issue therefore outweighs other considerations. As for the rest of the proposal, it behooves us to practice patience and fiduciary responsibility by insisting on an open and inclusive 4-step process outlined above. One final point. That needs to be made, and I've heard it from many board members, is that we need to be, when it comes to spending large sums of money, we need to be data-driven. In a zero-sum game, the board needs to consistently ask the question, what data do we have to show that this particular program is effective? For example, when we're listening to Avid and we're loving what they're doing, we still need one final piece of data. How are these kids, these young men and women, doing when they get to Cabri or when they get to UCSC? So we should be data-driven. By waiting until after the board hears from the math RTI coordinators in April 2016, the board may be better able to answer one aspect of this question. And one final issue that needs clarification is the financial impact of this proposal on the rest of the budget. It's a $572,000 proposal. You know, about half of that for 16-17, half of that for 17-18. What other one-time monies are out there? I noticed that Dr. Ferguson, am I correct in that? We're floating in equity and RTI coaching. I don't see how it fits in to the expenditure of all one-time monies. For example, does this $572,000 constitute all the one-time money we will have for next year, or will we have additional one-time money? If yes, how much are we projecting at this time? A presentation from the finance department is always useful. Let's look at it. Needless to say, and I'm back to where I started, the objections raised tonight to the district's proposal are not about mathematics or special ed, science, English, history, or world language, or PE. It may well be, particularly after hearing Angela's excellent presentation, that after an open and transparent process, the board decides to spend this money in exactly the same way that is proposed tonight. What is crucial is that we model and practice due process. Thank you.
Other questions from the board? And Sheila?
Well, I kind of hesitate to ask small questions now after, because I think there's a lot to say about Jeremy's, but my questions, one of them was, you said there will be money, there will most certainly be money in the future. Well, why do you expect more resources in the fall? when you were talking about social studies, and so I was wondering why you expect more resources. Seems like a very silly little question, but...
Perhaps I'm being optimistic, but, you know, we've seen a pattern of when the adoption is finalized at the state level, then there's a recognition of first publishers need to create materials, and then there does need to be release time for teachers to both... There needs to be funds for both the purchase of materials and then for teachers to be able to work with those materials. So I'm anticipating that there will be some funding. I think Jeremy's right that I don't have that information at hand right now. That may be something that we get from CSBA. They're lobbying for additional funds. We have ongoing sources of funding that we can use to provide teacher release. Title II is dedicated to that. It's dedicated to professional development. And so that is an ongoing source. It's nowhere near the amount of money that we're looking at here, but it can help us with one-time types of training and support.
Deb?
Can you summarize the timeline and the stakeholders that were involved? I mean, but the last meeting you heard from specialized teacher and from union leadership about the input that they've given. So I just would like to remind you of who was involved.
Yeah. Well, I want to say firstly that we collect information about teacher needs on an ongoing basis through our LCAP survey. So last year, math came up through the LCAP surveys, and we both through teachers and through our students, and it came again. I think I shared that in January, that an area of concern for our elementary teachers and for our secondary teachers was math instruction and support, and then the science standards as well. So that's part of our ongoing cycle of asking teachers to share with us their needs. We are required by the grant, and it's our great privilege to have monthly meetings with the bargaining units. And so we're able to, at one of those meetings in the fall, I want to say it was November, but it may have been a little earlier, to share, here's what we're thinking, what are you thinking? And got some feedback from them that moved us more in the direction of the PAR teacher. Heard that this was something that they heard amongst their teachers as well, a need for a coach. We shared with our leadership teams and asked them to represent not only themselves as principals, but really what were they seeing at their sites, what were some strong needs, both in terms of teacher development and then student outcomes. And so it's really through those processes that we came to this recommendation. Following our last meeting, I sent out an email to everyone in the district. And I was a little nervous because that's a lot of people. And I'll tell you that I didn't get a lot of responses, but the teachers who responded represented an array of disciplines, and they didn't write just a paragraph. I'm really grateful for those who did respond. They wrote paragraphs. They shared with me some of the work that they're doing that we were not aware of or that only their site administrator has been working with them on. So I definitely see that there could be more to this process. Probably not 435 people emailing me, but another way to have kind of a town hall. And I see that as an ongoing need because, again, as I started off tonight, there are the needs that are represented through student outcomes that we are really holding close because those student outcomes are determining their future. They're in some ways acting as the gatekeeper. And there are those needs that are not part of that data that we need to surface and respond to as well.
I'd just like to add, too, that Angela also met with RTI leads and teacher coaches who are working out in the field with a lot of teachers, talking about what their needs are and supporting them with different things. And I'd also like to share that there's more timely issues than just the FTE and the coach. We're planning summer professional learning. And right now, we have to plan for that. We have to let teachers know that that's available to them, if it's going to make it happen, if it's going to fit into their schedules. And that's a really critical piece of this. As far as the state was concerned, we did go through the steps that we needed to go through, and we included the stakeholders that we need to? Can we always work at getting more? We've been working over the last 2 years to really get more teacher voice and buy-in through surveys to get, you know, teacher input every fall. We started that last year. We started this year. We had huge response. And we, having the gift of teachers released also allows us to hear teacher voices through teacher leaders in a different way that we didn't have before. It's difficult to have a process that doesn't set up false expectations. Mm-hmm. Because although this looks like it's a lot of money, it doesn't go very far when you're talking about teacher release time. Mm-hmm. Or when you're talking about teacher pay for professional learning. It doesn't go as far as we'd like it to go. Our teachers, Lai and I said this last time, the other thing we know about good professional development is it needs to be focused and deep. We can't, if we spread this out and met the needs of everyone, we wouldn't meet anybody's needs because it would be very shallow. So, and it's our, we're, right now, and I said this last time too, our math teachers and our science teachers are being asked to make the most significant shifts. And alongside them are special education teachers because they're supporting kids and accessing all those content areas. That is where we've allocated those monies at this time in this recommendation, and there is teacher voice in it. There's administrator voice in it. Could we get better at it? Always. We could get better at it.
Dee Dee?
I have a question that I'm not quite sure who to address this to, but what I think I hear Jeremy proposing is that we make a decision about spending part of these funds for the first year, and then we look at some data and make another decision about how to spend the remaining portion of the funds. My question is this money in the bank that we can have that flexibility with, or is this something that we have to decide how we're going to spend every last dollar at this point in time?
So that's a great question. We it's very similar to the one-time money we receive for Common Core. We need to submit to the state an itemized, this is the amount that we plan to spend for each of those areas. And so we would drill down and go line by line, release time, stipends for coaching, those types of expenditures. We would then, if we made changes to that, resubmit. But we do need to submit a plan that is for the full 2 years before we can spend the money. So it could be staged, it could be, you know, we'll spend less money that first year and more money that second year. And there does need to be a data component. That's a piece of why I shared with you. Those are data points that not only express the need, those should also be the data points that we're using to measure the impact. Mm-hmm. So 46% of students proficient on the CASP, as a result of this training, we should see an increase. So we would use those data points to monitor as well. So my answer to your question is the state would, before we spend any money, we need to submit a plan for all the money, but we can make adjustments as we go.
Sheila?
Okay, I also don't know really where to ask this, but I feel like Jeremy struck something in me in terms of, in general, budget decisions, that it often seems to people in the community that have talked to me that they don't, that they're waiting for the chance to weigh in, and it doesn't happen. And all of a sudden decisions have been made. And since I've been on the board, I've learned that balance with the fact that we have staff whose job it is to figure out what's needed. So it's, to me, it's a real balance, but it's a balance that I've been a bit uncomfortable with having. When a need gets so great and it doesn't make it to the front, then if we, for instance, with supplies, when we gave supplies, then we hear from everybody, well, wait a minute, if I'd known you were going to be talking about this, I would have got my word in too. And I see their point that they're waiting for a chance to be able to say something about their values in what they hope the money goes for. So on the one hand, I welcome a discussion about making more room for that, because I'm not sure that just teachers, leaders, and administrators are enough for that. On the other hand, as Jeremy was talking about the four steps, my time here, I thought about making a committee. Just, I had a headache immediately, and you know how long it takes to make a committee work and to get the committee up to speed, and then to try to come up with some recommendations, which, as Chris said, you then have to balance with how you know that money can only be spent on a few things. And so I guess I'm just asking, it would seem to me that if we stopped for too long, there'd be no time for you to develop the program. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I wanted to hear a little bit about that, along with the balance of, yes, I actually do think that I've just spent too much time in agony trying to figure out when was that point that I could get in and make sure that the things I've been hearing from the community are being considered and addressed. And if I feel that way, how do the teachers feel, and how does the community feel? So
yeah.
It's kind of a two-sided question, but anything would help.
So I want to share that well in advance of even hearing that we might receive this money, we had to put together, this is that responsibility piece of, even if you don't have money, you have a responsibility to really strengthen your program. And so we didn't know that we'd have this money. We did, however, begin planning what would be a good model to support our teachers with the math adoption. And many of us who've taught know that if the adoption doesn't have coaching and support, then those books will go sit in the corner. And they won't get the implementation that our students really need, and the teachers won't have the support they need to do the full implementation. So well in advance of this, we were in conversations with math teachers, with principals, about what would a good model look like. And we looked at the middle school model, where they had George Martinez released providing coaching, co-teaching with some of our teachers, looking at the assessments, and that's the model that we want to bring moving forward. So there is a sense of urgency. It's not that we developed this in November when we knew we had money. We've been looking for some time. How are we going to support this model? We have a team of about 13 teachers who, in the secondary level, who are ready to give us 4 days in August to be trained in the new curriculum. And they're willing to do that because they know that we're going to provide them support. I'm not sure how we're going to do it. This is the funding source that we would be using. It won't be a one-off. It won't be, this is what I learned in August, and maybe I'll hear something about it later in the year. So I just want to reinforce that we didn't come up with this plan because of the money. We've had this plan, and we've been looking for what would be a funding source.
Comments from the public?
I've been serving the school district for almost 20 years now. And yes, you're absolutely right that there are people out in the community that are not all that crazy about this school district. But this school district has consistently over the years gone to the public and asked for their confidence. And our public has, year after year, a bond issue, a parcel tax, they've always supported us. I think this is an opportunity to shore up our math and science and other programs. I think Chris is absolutely right. It's not all that much money. When we see the statistics that we saw tonight, there can not be any doubt in any of your mind about the immediacy, how much we need this money, and we need to spend it as quickly and as effectively as we possibly can. So I would urge all of you to go ahead and take the plunge and vote to to expend this money. This is what you pay your administrators for, is to do this kind of forward thinking. Thank you for listening.
Any other comments from the public? Any more board deliberation? Patty?
I just wanted to make a comment. I'd like to thank Chris for the perspective and Angela, and also Jeremy for a perspective that I'd like to be moving towards. It doesn't necessarily mean that it may come to fruition this evening, but it is the crux of what the LCFF is all about. And so a stepped model that is given with reports that are data-driven is absolutely welcome. I also do wish that we had had the opportunity to hear your report last week. And I also think for the administrators to take note that this was brought forward, these monies were brought forward with the understanding that they may not be moved in one meeting. So the state was letting us know that an engagement process needs to be followed. So Jeremy, thank you for bringing some steps, and we'll see how it goes.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I would simply suggest whether the board votes for or against, and of course I'll vote against because of procedural questions, that you take your case and you make it to each of the sites. And yes, it's a little bit time-consuming, but a 15-minute presentation at lunch, what it does, at least for teachers, it involves them. It lets them know your priorities, and it informs them as well. And so I think a brief lunchtime meeting is in order. I appreciated hearing what you had to say. I still have objections, but thank you.
Sheila.
That sounds like a good idea. And maybe not this time with this, because my inclination is to support this because it's late in the year to be establishing it, and there's a lot of thought to it. But I had the same reaction. I saw George Martinez during the summer, and we spent about 40 minutes out in the parking lot talking about math. And one of my thoughts afterwards was I really wished that that conversation, that understanding of the need in the district and how we could proceed was something that was available to be heard to some of the people who have been concerned about us spending too much money on math or on science or anything else. That one of the reasons I like what Jeremy just said is that although I think the union represents a lot of that, and I think you're asking the union, and I think that's great, there's a certain amount of being able to give the teachers a chance to put their input and maybe they don't need to, maybe we need to more than they do, I don't know. But it seems to me like it's moving in the direction of making sure there's an open process, not top down, but also bottom up. And I like the idea, I don't think it's going to affect how I would vote on this tonight, but my hope would be that this conversation doesn't just disappear as a result, because it's been something that has been concerning me for a while, and I'd like to see us be able to continue to talk about it. But I do see the need for math, and I have been able to hear the conversations and really appreciate this movement. So it's not affecting so much for me tonight's vote.
Okay, we have a recommendation to approve the funding plan for the Educator Effectiveness Funding Grant. Do we have a motion?
I move approval of the funding grant as a final reading.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
6-1.
Thank you.
Okay, now it is 8.3.2, the school safety plans.
So we'll bring our director, Eileen Brown, back up. I think the plan was to have you just sit up there, so she got a little break. Once a year, we bring our safety plans for review, and again, I mean, works closely with the principals, both in elementary and secondary. to ensure that this plan is not just a once-a-year document, but that it's a living document that reflects the work.
These were plans that I brought to you. They run on a timeline from March 1st to March 1st. So they start in the spring, continue through the fall and the winter. And we'll be requesting your approval of these plans for this 16-17 March 1st to February 28th year. The purpose of the plan is to ensure a safe and orderly environment where students and staff are safe physically and emotionally. You'll see the plans are set up in four different components. The first one is focused on school climate and creating a caring and connected community. And we really look at people and programs in that area. The second component is the physical environment. And as we've done this year after year, we've really moved away from looking at things like broken windows or needing curtains up because we've been able to keep doing those things. So really in this area, we're looking at creating an environment that communicates respect for learning and individuals and really asking, is this a safe place for kids to be, again, both physically and emotionally? Component three is pretty basic. We're looking at how do kids get to and from school and is it safe? So you'll see the routes they take, the parking lot situation, and really we do look at that and look at, do we have students who aren't making it to school because it's not safe? They have to go through a neighborhood that isn't safe. They might not have if they're too young, they might not really have a way to get to school. So we're always trying to mitigate those factors. And the fourth one is our disaster preparedness. You'll see the emergency response plans that we have for each site. What I thought I would do this year is just take some of the goals that were set last year and then let you know how we did. So part of the plan each year is to reflect on the goals you set last year, look at the data, and see if you met your goals or not. So last year at this school, it said there will be a 20% decrease in the number of behavior referrals for class misconduct and defiance. And then the school had the strategies for how they were planning to do that. They were going to refine their tier ones, which is considered your school-wide strategies, the things that impact everyone at the school. And then they were going to implement specific activities. So this plan reported that they surpassed their goal. They went from 82 to 65 classroom referrals for misconduct and defiance, and that was a 21% decrease. And the number of behavior referrals overall decreased significantly from 353 to 79, a 78% decrease. So this school went all out in this past year to really talk about what can students handle in the classroom, what's an appropriate time to send a student out of class, missing learning time, get an agreement among the staff, what are those school-wide rules, what are those classroom behavior management systems that we need to put in place that can impact everyone so that we can really maintain an orderly environment in the classroom and not have students having to leave. So they had this incredible change. This school also implemented trauma-informed schools. And so they're actually using those skills, and this is one of the impacts that we were hoping to see. This school decided they were going to look at their Healthy Kids Survey and really see if they could impact the caring relationships. The Healthy Kids Survey is given every 2 years statewide. It's given in 5th, 7th, 9th, and 11th grade. So it's really a tiny snapshot, a one-day survey, but maybe it's just your 5th, maybe it's just your 7th, it might be 9th or 11th at high school. It gives us a little bit of information. And this one was talking about students have an adult they trust to help them when there's a problem. And that's a specific set of questions that are asked. In this school, they said that they did not reach that goal. However, we give an additional survey called the Social Emotional Health Survey to our 9th graders where they were reaching that goal. They were 86%, happy to be at school was 90, part of the school was 90. So I'm not really sure how to look at two different surveys, two different results. They're given at different times of year. This is just 9th, the other one's 9th and 11th. But we want to present this data because we don't always meet the goals exactly, but we keep working at it. We look at what did we do? What was our action plan? What can we change? What do we have to really implement better? And maybe the strategies we chose weren't exactly hitting the mark, so we continue. So often when you see the safety plans, you'll see the same goal with an additional action step or a different plan. So I wanted to say we don't always meet our goals, but we're constantly improving, and that's really how the safety plans work. We often are working on the same thing all the time. We're just trying to get better and better at it. This was a goal at one of our schools. These were the things that they were planning to do, again, to develop those caring relationships. And what the school said was we didn't actually do that. We didn't do what we thought we were going to do. We did something completely different. And sometimes that happens. You write a plan in January, February, and then you say, well, that was a really great idea. And as you start implementing, you say, you know what? This isn't really going to hit the mark. It's not really going to do what we thought it was going to do. So as you dive into it, you're really adjusting on your feet. So the school didn't implement the same plan, but they had this incredible impact on what they wanted to do. And so these plans are living documents. They allow us to change as we go, really stay nimble and responsive. Sometimes we try something, we read about it, it sounded great, we try to implement it, and we realize this isn't going to work in our school at all. We don't even have the resources, or this isn't the right approach for what we're trying to do. So you'll see that there'll be changes in the plan as we go. The school decided that they were really looking at their Healthy Kids Survey data, and Healthy Kids Survey, we used to be able to get, we got reports out based on students who, again, students are self-identifying, self-survey, whether they belong to the LGBTQ community. This year we didn't get the results broken down quite the same way. But this school decided that that was an area where those students were reporting higher levels of harassment than other students at the campus, really wanting to do something about that, so decided they were going to implement, get their GSA going again. These were the action steps that they planned to take, and this is what they were able to do. So they didn't really have an active group. GSA is one of those groups that sometimes you have a really active cohort of kids come through, and then they move on, and no one picks it up. We don't really want it to be that way. We want to keep these groups going. We're lucky we have a partnership with the Diversity Center, and they have a specific person designated who works with GSAs throughout the county. So they'll come and help and make sure that we keep this going no matter what student steps up. And if no student steps up, we're able to still keep it going with the students who are there. We don't need that gung-ho leader, but we're able to keep it up with the staff advisor, the help of the Diversity Center, and the students who are there. We want to make sure our students know this club exists, that it's there. We've been told by students that even though they never came to a meeting, just knowing that club was on their campus made them feel safer and made them feel welcome. So we want to be sure we always keep it going. So at this school, they were able to do this. They were able to take over 100 students to the YES conference that was district-wide. They were able to host their own event on campus. So they met every goal that they had set for that club, and want to let you know that it continues to grow and it continues to be active. Some of the component two steps, the physically safe at school. This school wanted to reduce their risk index for students of color. So we're looking at our disaggregated discipline data. Do students have the same risk of being referred to the office no matter what their color is? And often you'll find that is very disproportionate. At this school, they wanted to be sure that it was proportionate. So they were going to implement all of these activities, and you'll see this is part of our PBIS program. And here's where they came up to. So they didn't quite make their goal, but they moved towards it. So just putting some focus on that and really incorporating all of the belief work that we're learning about race, changing, helping people be aware of their own implicit biases, and really looking at that referral data is making a difference at this school. So again, we didn't quite hit. We're always challenged when we set goals because it's hard to know, like, is 85% good? Is 65% good? Should we say 100%? We're not really ever sure. How do you actually set a goal? So we take a stab at it, we set it, and then we keep trying to get there. So you can see they're almost exact. You know, they're fairly equal now. And I'm sorry because I don't have the statistical data. I don't know how big a difference those are. If I looked at the numbers, I would have a sense, so I probably could have been more helpful to bring you that information. I'll try to get it to you. Another school wanted to impact their social emotional health survey data. So the staff are really looking at this data. This is what kids are telling us. We want to do something about it. All the things they said they were going to do last year in their plan. Got to where, you know what, we didn't quite make it. And sometimes the questions aren't the same. So they didn't ask that question this year, so we don't have a way of measuring it. We didn't know they were going to ask that question, and we would have figured out how to ask it ourselves. But we know this is a problem. We saw changes in our playground and our recess time. We're going to keep going at it. The last part of the plan is our emergency response plans. We work in these four areas: prevention, preparedness, response, and recovery. I want to just give an example. Today we did a Code Red training at Harbor High. We've been doing our Code Red trainings at each of our schools. As we walked out, Dick said, you know, this went really well this year. Did you notice there really weren't that many questions? There really weren't that many people upset by the presentation, which makes us think we're getting better prepared. This is starting to feel like, okay, we know what we're supposed to do. Okay, I'm not freaked out by you telling me to, you know, run, hide, or fight. I'm getting used to it. The questions now are more about, when we do the drill for this, what if we tell our students ahead of time, and kind of more in a preparation way. So I feel like our preparedness work is really starting to take hold. People are feeling prepared, and we know that if you're prepared when something really happens, it may help you not get into a panic mode. It may, we hope so. So those are the parts of the plan. What you have to approve tonight are the coming year's plans, and again, pretty strong data analysis, goals that connect to that data, and then a cycle back to, did we meet the goal or not, and if not, why not? What are we going to do differently? And we're looking at them throughout the year, because we don't want to wait until February to say, oh darn it, we forgot to do that, we didn't meet our goal. We're looking at them in an ongoing way to say, you know, what we're doing isn't really hitting it, or hey, we're right on, let's do it even better.
Questions from the board? Comments from the public?
Let me share a few things wearing two hats. One, let me share a few things wearing the union's hat. And I'll talk about, you know, being on the side of the house that's these classified sports staff, which for the most part are not in any of the trainings. They're not included. They don't attend the faculty meetings because the district doesn't want to pay for them to attend the faculty meetings. So left out a lot of this program. They're not in. That's just on all of them. So when it comes to training for emergencies, they're really not there. Food service doesn't have any training in emergencies, what happens, what to be done. In the classroom itself, the teacher had some of the training. Classified don't. When it comes to LGBT questions, and they're not included in the trainings. They're out of the loop. And yet they work directly with kids. So it's kind of interesting that that's there. Then on the other piece, when it comes to safety issues, someone forgot to talk to the ground troops. Monday morning, I had 13 guest teachers. 13. We would have had a lockdown drill. Would those 13 teachers know what to do? No. There's some things missing in the program. And sometimes it might be good to consult the ground troops. Because I'm out there every day, on the perimeter, all around. We're wide open. Soquel High, for example, it's probably the most open site that I've ever worked at in any of our system, within the system. Before the middle, most secure. So we could learn, Mission Hill can be like before the middle, are very secure. Our elementary schools are not so secure. We had a situation where some keys were lost or stolen, I should say, at one site. Keys have not been reissued. They have not done the locks, which should have been done. Somebody made a decision, oh, that must cost too much money. Therefore, it's not being done. Again, it's a question of safety over what students are. And who's going to make that call? Gee, it's 50 cents to rekey the key. We're not going to do it because it costs X. Where's the safety of the students concerned? So there are issues there. There's still a long way. We have a long way to go. We're fooling ourselves to think that we are some kind of safe state. We're not. Until all of us are trained, all of us are involved, we know what we do forward. We can't just train a few.
I'd like to add that I'm looking forward to one of the things that's on our agenda to talk to the classified staff, leadership staff about when we meet this month is about professional learning and what professional learning areas they see as needs. So we're looking forward to that conversation as we move forward this month.
Any other comments from the public? Patty.
I just wanted to make a comment that I know that at one of the particular sites that they were going to map all of their mains and the word is not coming to me right now, but your basic facilities, and sometimes in the preparedness piece, you know, we'll need to know where the gas shutoffs are, the water shutoffs are, and I am in hopes just to prolificate that across the district and work with Trevor and our staff to make sure that all our sites has that master piece to find. And
we do that annually, Patty, just so you know, at every school site.
Okay.
As a part of a process that it has as part of a safety inspection we do every year.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear on that. And then I do want to say, though, you know, Mr. Chakanaka, thank you for giving a grounds point of view. My time spent on the board here, I have seen these plans come far and wide. So we've started and we're working out, and it's great to hear that perhaps we can be more prepared by training within a different area, and I do believe that the district is moving towards that. So thank you for your input, and thank you for the work they do on the other side.
Sheila.
Well, thank you for this report, and I think one of the first things I want to say is I've been with Santa Cruz City Schools on and off since 1971. And I sometimes think about the lack of any of this kind of thing that we had then. I mean, even in the 4 years that I've been here, it has become so much better developed. And certainly back in those days, we didn't think much about these issues at all. That might have been part of the time. One of the questions that went through my mind when you were presenting was when the students said that they didn't feel, I can't remember what it was it close to an adult or connected to an adult? And you said, but yet they felt like they did answer yes to questions about feeling as if they had people they were close to. And my first thought was, why wouldn't that be the adults? Like, to me, what struck me is that they were dividing the closeness. They weren't seeing it towards that the adults were not making that connection. And then Robert got up, and I was wondering if perhaps that is one of the reasons why. I know Jane Weed's program that she brings into the schools, she won't do it until everyone in the school on the staff is trained. And her reasoning behind that is that you can't have staff that are responsible for the grounds and for security and such not trained in the same thing that the teachers and the counseling staff is trained in. And then if the whole community of adults together is able to allow for that safety and security, then your rate of being able to get it goes much higher. So I guess I changed from just wanting to ask a question to wanting to support Robert in saying that, because I really do think that for my daughter and her friends, the staff, the classified staff that worked in the schools, were some of the people that they turned to when they were in a different, and they were the ones who knew that my daughter was in the bathroom putting on makeup when she was supposed to be in class. I mean, they knew that, and they would go and yell at her at the door, you know, come out,
time.
Supposed to be in class, you know, and now she's graduated from college, yay. But, you know, I would urge us to really look into adding that capacity for them to be trained.
I agree, and I also agree with Chris that we are doing that. So in our elementary schools, we're implementing PBIS. The classified staff have all been trained. The Cassiano retreat that we had last week, we brought three health clerks with us, knowing that that's often where students go. So I think we are doing that, and we're figuring out how to fund it. I agree with Robert with the emergency preparedness training. What the principals are trying to do is bring their classified staff together to give that training to them, and it's hard because their schedules are all different, so they're trying to figure out a way to come in a little late, come in a little early for this one-time training. So it is challenging, and I think that we are moving that direction, and I think you have a really good point. The more we do that, that may be the strategy to raise that caring adult. Now we provided the emergency training to our buildings and grounds crew, knowing that they're often on a site and they need to know what to do. So I think that it's all important training, and we do need to do more of it and do it better. I think that I'm curious about what you just said. That would be interesting to track now.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to add that I really want to appreciate Eileen's leadership around this. Our safety plans have grown tremendously under her leadership, and I remember being an assistant principal writing a safety plan and not really knowing exactly how to approach it or what to do with it, and I had the safety committee, which was a small group, and as we look at RTI as a framework both for academic success and school climate and culture, you see those school climate and culture goals in that safety plan. And so it's a part of that framework of how we're looking at making schools where kids feel safe, both physically and emotionally, healthy and ready to learn. And those are all pieces and really important leadership that Eileen has provided through student services.
So we have a recommendation to approve the school safety plans.
Move approval.
I'm sorry, and that was?
Claudia.
Oh, second.
Sheila seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. Okay, the second interim report.
Good evening, Board of Trustees. As Chris introduced me, I'm Kyle Rucker. I'll be serving as the Interim Director of Finance here. And a special experience for me as I'm an alumni of Soquel High. I'm actually sitting, and I don't know if this was intentional, Chris, where my own desk was for math. So that's where I'm currently located. So, can you have the platform?
Molly has
it.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Molly. So what I'll be covering is the second interim report, and I think you're probably all familiar with the fact that we have four reporting periods each year. We start with the adopted budget. We go to the first interim. The adopted budget will be adopted July 1st of every year. The first interim is actual data through 10/31 and is reported to you in December, December 15th. The second interim report, which we're looking at now, will be data through January 31st, and then we'll have a projected budget that takes us closer to that March 9th deadline, or date today, and is due by March 15th. In some instances, a district will need to file a third interim. And I believe we will be filing a third interim by choice, not through requirement this year. And then the final period is unaudited actuals where we come back and come full circle to report what the actual expenses were for the year as opposed to the budget data you'll be looking at today. There's three certifications. Positive certification certifies that the district will be able to meet its financial obligations for current year plus two. A qualified is a may not meet situation. And a negative situation is they will not meet. And we will be filing a positive certification for second interim. A quick look at our unrestricted revenues. What we see is that we have a relatively flat trend between first and second interim. So overall revenues have increased slightly by about $66,000. Our unrestricted expenditures have increased more than that, so we'll take a look at that. So here's our unrestricted revenues. So those have increased a total of $66,857. This is a graph that will show you what that revenue comes in as, and I think the big thing we all like to look at is LCFF sources, because we know that is the primary funding source for schools these days. It's a combination of what was our old revenue limit funding and categorical funding that has been moved over to that local control funding formula. The changes in our unrestricted expenditures, they have increased more, and this is primarily the results of salary negotiations with the certificated unit. And there's a graph showing. And the big thing with all school districts across the state of California is we're a salary agency. We work with people, we work with students, we work with employees. So the most of our budget, in this case, it looks like we're at almost 90%, a little over 90% of our unrestricted expenses are salaries. Changes in our unrestricted fund balance, and what I want to highlight here is our next item will be our public disclosure for the SCCCE unit. And so I think what we'll want to keep in mind is our undesignated fund balance. At first interim, we were projecting to end 15-16 with a $6.4 million fund balance. And as of second interim, because of the adjustments to our expenditures, we're looking at 4.4, so a drop of $2 million there. So our key revenue assumptions are that property taxes will increase by 1.5% for the secondary and 2% for the elementary. RDA revenue is budgeted based on the county J29, and we have gap funding rates using the SSC guidance, that's School Services of California, which you may all be aware of. The other thing that Chris, Jimmy, and myself now have been talking about is the CERS and PERS rate, which I'll touch on a little bit further in the presentation. So the multi-year projection is a tool we use to look at year-over-year. Historical analysis is important for us for getting a gauge on what will be our expenses for the following year, taking into account everything we know that's coming up. So this is a look at 14-15 against 15-16. And our next slide is 16-17 versus 17-18, and it's showing where we're headed. And what we'll take a quick look at is at the bottom of this slide where it says undesignated. By the end of 17-18, our undesignated fund balance, and those are kind of available funds. We don't have a current plan plan in place for those. So it's a general fund balance is $924,000. And we're at 4.24% unrestricted reserve, which goes towards that 3% reserve we're required by the state of California to hold. So the STRS outlook, so this is what we've been looking at a lot, is that between 14-15 and 2021, the STRS rate is expected to more than double. For Santa Cruz City Schools, that's an additional cost just based on increasing STRS rate, not on increasing salaries based on step and column. $6.6 million is what it's estimated at, and we're on a $73 million budget, so that's an almost 10% increase on our budget, just driven by STRS. For PERS, we have a similar situation, and the PERS rate is projected to increase from 11.771% in 14-15 to 20.4% in 2021. So not quite doubling, but very close. And that's going to result in an estimated cost by 2021 of 2.1 million more. So in addition to the STRS, that's something we're very cognizant of and looking towards the future for that and how we can prepare for that.
Could you just repeat the percentage increase on that?
I apologize, yeah. It's 11.7, I'll round, 11.7% to 20.4% between 2014-15, so last year, and 2020 to 2021. So things we're looking forward to are looking to the future for, and considerations we're keeping in mind for future budgets is that we have Measure O, the parcel tax, coming up. We have our goal is to continue to reduce deficit spending on for the district. The goal is a balanced budget. I think that's something we've been striving for some time, over revenues equal expenses, and we've been spending down fund balances in anticipation that we will be moving towards that balanced budget in the future. We will be preparing, as of now, we're planning on preparing that third interim financial report. It's optional, but it's something we find useful. The 2016-17 LCAP and budget adoption, so Chris and Jimmy, I know, have been working on LCAP and what that will mean for our budget. And that very much, in your LCAP, you have to clearly delineate what you're going to spend on, because you're not allowed to spend outside of that for LCAP purposes. The governor's May revise is coming up. That will be in May, so we'll have a little bit more information. It's unfortunately not in time for the third interim, but it will be for our estimated actuals that we'll submit as part of our adopted budget and the adopted budget, of course. We have increased obligations resulting from LCFF, which includes CERS, PERS, the American Care Act, Health and Family Act, and the underfunding state and federal programs. And so our recommendation to the board today for the second interim is to approve the second interim report with a positive certification, with adjustments to be made for the third interim.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I got something else. That's just a joke. I had a really good meeting with Kyle, and I want to thank him, and Chris. And what I'm going to talk about in just for a few minutes is books and supplies. And it's fascinating to me. And what I think I'm proposing is a board study session where we can dig in to books and supplies and talk about what it means, why the money there fluctuates so much, perhaps dispel some myths and rumors or theories about where it's at. Because I remember from a teacher union point of view, we'd always look at books and supplies and go, aha, that's where they're hiding the body, so to speak. It's a joke. And I think obviously there are misunderstandings there, and so I think it's in our interest to take a look at it. I don't want to bore you with it, but what I did in my own fairly simplistic way is I just went through the first interim report. Now, I have hard copies of it, and I shared this with Chris and Kyle, and I thought of very productive meetings. And you may not follow along, but I get 811,000 one place, 3,211,000 someplace else, up to 4 million, up to someplace else, burgeoning up to 4,821,000, then down to 3,644,000. The numbers are all over the place on books and supplies, and I'm getting more and more confused. And so I'm thinking, I'm not totally enumerate. It would be really helpful, I think, to have a board study session where we can just sort of dig into this budget, maybe just look at books and supplies, look at the history of what we've had, where we can spend that money. We might also, if we're really ambitious, look at services and other operating expenditures, which would be the 500s or the 5,000s, correct me if I'm wrong. But I really think it would be in our interest as a board to spend an hour or two in front of the public looking at that particular piece. Because the other aspects of the budget, again, thanks so much for bearing with me, are fairly certain. Certificated salaries, classified salaries, employee benefits. I think we can all understand that. But this mysterious books and supplies. So I came away from our one-hour meeting somewhat enlightened, or at least I think on the right path, and I'm suggesting that the board would do well to spend some time on it because, that's all I'm saying. Thank you.
So it was a good conversation, and actually I had something clarified for myself in that conversation.
Yep.
So one of the things I just... Jeremy's talking about the different funds have books and supplies, and when you see books and supplies under the cafeteria fund, it doesn't seem to make sense, but that's what we buy our food with. So it's helping us, you know, have more clarity about how that's used, because it is a general term, and it also becomes a holding account before a budget is in a department moves money into a position or other things. So that's why you'll see a lot of variation. But what I want to know from the board is, would you like to have an opportunity to have that conversation, or is that something that the whole board would like to see us do moving forward?
Yes, please.
So we have a motion to add. I'd like to know how this is going to work. Are we going
to
add?
I'd like a
discussion also.
About adding this study session?
Well, how would it work? Because our study sessions, I think we've already planned what they're going to be. I want to know,
replacing,
would we be adding
one
or replacing one before I vote on it?
So I think Jeremy has made a motion.
I would move that sometime before we adopt this year's budget, time to have an open study session focusing on the budget and looking at books and supplies. Yes, and I think if we need to carve out another hour and a half sometime, I think it's well worth our time. Again, coming back to the thread, for me at least, in terms of openness, transparency, we're all in this together sort of thing. Three Musketeers.
I don't know where to put this information. This is not an item that's on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking simply for protocol reasons that this would be taking place at your next agenda committee meeting.
Okay, great.
I'd like to clarify that, because Nancy, I believe that this is related to the budget.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm.
So is this
a motion? Are we having two separate motions then during this budget discussion?
Oh, I see what you're
to
saying.
To adopt,
right.
With the...
Well, we haven't made a motion to adopt.
Right, right.
So we're doing this one first.
So I understand.
Yeah, no, but I think she's
right. But the recommendation is to approve the budget.
This isn't on there.
So I'm unclear as to where this will go into my notes.
Okay. I then rescind my motion until after we approve the budget, and we can revisit the second motion.
Mm-hmm.
Is that acceptable?
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd make an amendment to the approval of the budget.
Yeah, I think maybe it would be a friendly amendment to someone motioning to approve the budget.
With the addition of an additional...
Board study.
Board study.
Deb?
Do we have a budget study session on the calendar already?
We did our budget study session in December.
Mm-hmm.
And what is our one in June?
We have one in April on math, and we have one in June on governance.
Or June is governance.
Okay, so where are we right now? Are we friendly amending it? Did he move for a friendly amendment?
We haven't moved for approval yet.
We haven't moved
for
approval. We moved to approve the budget first.
So we have to approve first. I'm just thinking out loud. Jeremy, you may want to move for approval with the caveat that with approval we will carve out a day prior to the 31st of June to have a meeting specifically on that. So meeting with the approval, you tag a meeting to it.
That's not the motion.
There has not been a motion yet.
We haven't made a motion. I'm just giving a friendly suggestion.
Could we take this? Would it be okay to take this and figure it out in agenda committee? Like,
mm-hmm.
Look at the plan, figure out where we would add this additional meeting, and then pull the board on whether or not people can manage another meeting, or could we change the topic of one?
If you're asking me, my only concern, I really think it's important,
mm-hmm.
for us to do this, and I think it might be stronger to force the issue by making, from my point,
mm-hmm.
of view, by making a friendly amendment.
Okay, so will you make a motion make a motion, tack it on, and let's move it.
Let me do that now then. So then I'm making a friendly amendment to the approval of this first interim report, contingent upon us carving out a meeting sometime in May, let us say, as April and June seem to be booked, to have a 1.5 to 2 hour study session on books and supplies.
Got it.
So, for the purpose of moving this along, I will.
Do we have a second? Okay.
That's what I'm going to do, second it. But I would like to suggest that I had a question for the gentleman, and then with the question would come what I think might be a friendly amendment to your friendly amendment, which is the numbers you're giving and the reserve that's there is without property tax revenues?
No, it is for the multi-year projection. We budgeted at 2%.
So you budgeted with, but we don't have any idea what it's actually going to be?
2% is what we tend to use year over year as a projection for it, but we do not know the exact numbers.
Okay. So my, thank you. My friendly amendment would be that it would also include property taxes and understanding what the history has actually been for property taxes over the last 10 or 20 years, and because we never seem to know. So if we're going to do a budget study session, I would like to see that included, Jeremy, if you're willing.
Are we going to carve out a percentage, one for the other?
Sure. I'm willing to.
80-20, and I'm willing.
Okay. I'll take it.
I'm willing.
Are there question? Any more questions from the board?
I just had one to Kyle because it was making me think about how I've always thought about this. And our budget is a lot of times, I think some of the confusion, this is my perspective asking this question, is that they think of this as arithmetic and accounting is moving and flowing and all sorts of things. And so when we talk about books and supplies, do you consider that, am I correct in thinking that it's really just an accounting placeholder for you?
Absolutely. Well,
or for the district. I don't want to say for you.
No. So Chris, actually, after a meeting with Jeremy, had some great ideas about how we can take a look at those and see what they're tied to. And we've started taking those steps. So that might be part of something we could include as part of that budget session, or budget study session, to show you guys what those are. Because they're restricted dollars. So that number that we point to that's a large amount there is all restricted. So it's all tied to a specific purpose. It's not like our unrestricted funds where you can take that $4 million, or I think it was a $4 million restricted side of the budget, and move it to any purpose. So it's tied to very specific things.
So books and supplies are always restricted funds?
No, there's an unrestricted
side. Two components,
yeah.
Okay.
And so I think the unrestricted side of the budget was around $800,000, the restricted was $4 million for the same
Okay.
So, just to clarify, please, so what I have then is a motion from Mr. Shonick to approve the second interim report, contingent upon the board carving out a time in either April or May for a two-hour study session on books and supplies funding. Ms. Dr. Coonerty seconds the motion with the amendment that we include property taxes in the study session as well. A third amendment from Mr. Shonick approving the friendly amendment as long as it is an 80-20 split on the agenda. Are we good here?
Yeah.
80% being number four, books and supplies.
Yes.
Can
I propose
a friendly amendment to the friendly amendment?
No, I'm not proposing amendment. I'm proposing process. Can I propose that the agenda committee look at some potential times we might be able to bring back as an agenda item to vote on when we would do this. Is that so that we'd identify some potential dates and bring them back as an agenda item to vote on?
So then the original motion shouldn't specify April or May, and that you will bring back dates at a later time?
No, we can specify April and May.
Okay.
We're just going to bring back dates.
Okay.
For,
right,
for
the process
votes.
Piece. Because we want it before the it needs to be in April or May.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that proposal is not going to impact.
It's not going to impact the motion on the floor. It's just a checking with everyone for some direction on process.
Yes.
Are there comments from the public?
Psst.
I have a question on the parliamentary procedure with Robert's Rules of Order.
I think you have to get up, Jim, because
I'm
can't hear you.
Dr. Lockton, just so that we can keep it to one speaker.
I would like to suggest that
and I'm not an expert on Robert's Rules of Order, but I think what Mr. Shomik suggests changes the meaning of the original law motion, and would therefore you have to find some other device to have a study session. And I of course, I have no objection whatsoever about a further study session, even though books and supplies are perhaps at the most 2% of the budget. But that's only not my core opinion. Thank you.
Any other comments from the public?
A couple questions. Did you want to ask?
I also have you.
Allison, I have a question at hand before we vote. Yeah. Just so you know.
Okay. Mine's a new car. I don't want to do this. I've never been. You told me you were in the system. You know, it's always been my understanding in the past, when it comes to PERS, I'm not sure schools is the same, but the state takes that into account, and the state covers some of your PERS.
I can see
you're not happy with that.
Be happy if you can.
It made it sound like the sky's falling with these PERS increases, but in reality, the state's going to cover it.
So in the past, what happened with PERS is the state guaranteed we would never pay more than 13.02%. So what you had is you had a situation where our PERS rate is 8%, we're going to pay up to 13% regardless, and then anything over that the state of California will cut, they no longer will do that. That is gone. So what will happen is that any PERS increase comes forward, it's the district's burden. Now the state of California has absolved themselves of that debt. So now that the rates are going to exceed 13%, unfortunately we don't have that protection going forward. So.
And this is why we'll never see 2007-08 levels of funding, even though that's what the intent of LCFF was. We won't see it because of this tremendous increase in district responsibility for retirement.
Well, then this is an opportunity for our side and your side using CSBA to approach the government, to approach the state of California, to make sure that they know they have to help cover these costs. They can't just pass it on, pass through as they work.
Yeah, just have a couple little easy questions. The slide on the key revenue assumptions. The multi-year projection, the X's, they mean yes,
yeah, those are included in our assumptions.
Okay, and so
they didn't have a rate to display there, was the only reason they're an X.
Okay, so you're factoring in 8% for health and welfare for the three years increase.
Correct.
But it says certificated only, and I'm wondering why.
I'm going to defer to Chris on this. I apologize, Chris, but I think that's because classified bargaining agreement had not been certified at that point. We were still in negotiation. So
I'm sorry, I was looking at Robert's rules and point of orders on motion, so you're going to have to ask that question one more time, Mary. I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering why the assumption is being made that health and welfare benefit costs are increasing 8% for certificated only.
I do not know why that's there. That's a question we're going to have to bring to Jim. I don't know the answer to that question.
So the other question will be easy.
I think it may be a typo in the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
I know that the MYP is built on an 8% projection for both certificated and classified.
Yeah, it seems like it should be.
So I think this is a typo.
Okay.
It's
probably wrong.
Yes.
I'm 0% increase.
We'd really like to see a 0% increase. I think everybody would be good with that.
So my other question is just about the format of what's being published now. And what I'm seeing is what looks like part or most of or maybe all of this of the actual Sachs report for the first time in the board book.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is this all of the SACS report? In which case, I don't need to request it.
It is all of the SACS report. I will confirm that for you, Barry, just confirm it. I did compare it. Part of my preparation was to compare it against the first interim report, so it's form for form, the same as was submitted at first interim.
Okay. And so I like that it's included now. So I think that's an improvement. It's just more information that's available to the public without them having to make a request. So thank you.
Sheila.
Okay, at the risk of showing my stupidity, I believe that it was suggested that this report did not look as positive as the last one. And I also was quite impressed by how much information we got, but it got a little overwhelming at a certain point. So I'm dealing with classified, I'm dealing with certificated, I'm dealing with health and benefits, a lot of things that I knew changed, okay? And then I'm looking for what is this thing that may have changed coming down from the governor that may have made the picture not so rosy. And I was having trouble finding it. And it might have been because there's so much more information. But is there an answer to that question? Am I right? Or did I make that up?
I don't believe we have anything that's come down from the governor since first interim that has changed the second interim picture. What's changed with the second interim picture, and I'm talking 15-16, I apologize. So for the 15-16 year, is we changed that certificate salaries number. That's what the number is there. And what we'll see when we get to the next item, public disclosure, we're changing the classified as well.
So it's all within us. There's nothing that has changed in the external picture?
In the multi-year, it has.
Correct.
The multi-year has been informed by the January governor's budget assumptions. So the assumptions that the governor has given us in his January presentation on the budget has impacted the out years.
In what way?
It tightened up a little bit the what we were projecting for revenue.
Uh-huh.
For both supplemental dollars and base dollars in the LCFF formula.
So lessened it, you mean?
You know, I do believe it's slightly less than what we were projecting before, yes.
Okay, so that's probably what I heard, and I couldn't find it.
Much.
Okay, so it's a multi-year. If I'd looked further down, I would have seen it. All right.
But I don't, I think more, it's been, you know, as we move from first interim to second interim, you know, at first interim we tighten up the budget. We see what are our actuals. We tighten that more, and we're closer to actuals at second interim. So those are what you really should be looking for as we're moving forward. And then in third interim, you're going to see the impact of the bargaining unit agreement that we're going to make tonight.
Right. Okay.
And there's a classic adage of the moment a budget is printed, it's out of date. So as Chris noted, at second interim, we have a better picture of what the end of the year will look like. Because for our forecasting tools, we have half a year of data now. So one of the common tools we use is for salaries for both certificate and classified is you take and say, what are our costs to date? What was the last month's worth of expense? And then you can take that number and you can project that out times the number of months remaining to get a better estimate of salary. It's not perfect, and that's something we use as more as a tool to identify where we have budget exposure, and then we dig in deeper because you need to be a bit more detail-oriented to really fix the salary budget. So that thing, because this month I served 20 hours, next month I'll serve 10. So it's not a perfect estimation tool.
Yeah, and I appreciated it. It was overwhelming, but I appreciated it also.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I would add that the only potential light at the end of the tunnel is with health and welfare, because Jim and I did crunch the numbers. He assured me we budgeted $720,000 for an 8% increase. But if that comes down to a 4% increase, it's a saving of $360,000. It's $90,000 every percentage point it comes down. So let's say we get really lucky, and like this year, I believe it was just a 2% increase. The saving is $540,000, and that's a considerable chunk of change.
Okay.
Just a quick question to that, thinking about what you said, Jeremy. Was it only a 2% increase because we changed plans, that we shopped differently among stores, and will we have the opportunity to do that in the future, if so?
That is a great question.
That's a good question.
You know, because, you know, we've always budgeted eight. I immediately saw that and said eight. And knowing that if it's six, great, it's in the favor of the district to know that there is a bit of a cushion. I mean, things can get out of control quickly. And so the question being is, I know that there was a lot of hard work by the administration and the bargaining units to shop our plans, and will that always be available, and is that where the savings was realized?
Molly, can I do it?
Yeah, so we always do. We have a benefits committee that we're working with, and we've actually reached out to a different broker to see what their rates might be. There's a lot of interest from certificated to look to see where Kaiser was, so we've done that. So we meet together as a committee. CISC has their date coming into the county to let us know what their rates are in April.
Yeah.
In April.
Right before spring break.
So end of March, beginning of April, and so we'll be getting a quote from this other group as well. So yeah, always looking to see how we can bring it down. And like Jeremy said, last year was 2%, was great. We hadn't recognized that small in a while, but hopefully that trend will continue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
we have a
very complicated motion that has been seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? 7-0.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have me for one more.
It's not done yet.
Okay, so we are on 8.3.4, and we're going to begin the public meeting on tentative 2014, 2015, and 2015-16.
So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Kyle to you again to talk a little bit about what this tentative agreement and the disclosure of costs means for the district.
Absolutely. So we have a public disclosure agreement. Those who have served more than 1 year are probably very familiar with, or you're probably all here for the certificate. So we've seen it then. It's very long and detailed document like we see with our SAP form. So what I've done is I've put a one-page splash on the front that will give you a 3-year outlook and the impact of the agreement by fiscal year. On that sheet, and it's the one titled Total Cost of SCCCE Tentative Agreement by Fiscal Year. And what we aim to do with that is really give you a one-stop. I put it together for three purposes. One was, I need to get a handle on what the cost of the agreement was for the projection purpose. Two, I think it's a great tool for us to look at because of sometimes the forms provided by local and state agencies aren't as clean as we've seen. It's supposed to be something that will help both the board and our constituents understand what the cost of that agreement is. And it's also a tool I can use to communicate with the COE for their review purpose of our agreement. So there's five components. How we broke this out was there was five components. There was a 3% retro that went back to July 1st of 2014. And that piece itself, I've broken out on the lines 1 and 2 because the 3% retro for 14-15 is a one-time cost. The 3% retro that would be applied as of July 1, 2015, rolling forward from July 1st, 2014, is ongoing. That's a cost we will bear each year. So on that little splash page, you'll see that the 213 on the first line does not carry forward into 16-17 because it's a one-time cost is how we're viewing it there. The 260 for the 3% ongoing rolls forward into each fiscal year. There's a impact for 7 column. That's piece number 3. There's a cost of schedule migration for non-PERS members, and this was because we, in our tentative agreement, we have agreed to eliminate the non-PERS schedule and move all non-PERS members to the classified schedule, classified PERS schedule, which we'll rename to just the classified schedule going forward. Everybody will be on the same schedule there. And then there's a one-time 2.5% off-schedule payment, and you'll see that this cost will be a burden of the 16-17 fiscal year because of the timing of that payment. It's scheduled to be paid either July 31st or August 31st. That will be a 16-17 expenditure. Down below, it gives you the total cost of the agreement over that three-year period, as well as an average cost per year. You have the true cost per year up above, you have an average cost per year down below. So this was intended to be helpful. If it's not, we can not bring this document in the future. Moving on to the public disclosure document itself, the first page there really gives you a cost of the agreement. And the one of the reasons we put down together this splash page is this doesn't show the cost by year, it's an ongoing increase. It shows in that first year, not year two, and not year three. So that splash page gives you a better understanding of what the cost of that agreement is. There is one piece of non-salary or compensation-related bargaining unit language, which was around work calendars, and that we will be having a uniform start and end date on work calendars to better facilitate our business. So are there any questions about that?
Questions from the board? Questions from the public? Are you going to turn that on?
Comment.
Comment from the board.
I just wanted to say yes, this is helpful.
Okay, excellent. And I'll talk to Chris and Judy. It's something we can consider. I have a lot of old forms from past work lives that I've used to communicate to the board that give you a cleaner MYP. It's all the same numbers as SACs, and you can always verify against it. But as Jeremy pointed out, we have Fund 1 in the SACs document repeated three times because you have an unrestricted demonstration, you have a restricted and then you have a combined. It can be confusing to follow that. Further confusing is that the other funds don't break up that way, so you have inconsistent logic across them. So I can work with Chris and Jimmy if we want to see if we can provide what would be clearer information, making sure that it's always the same information as the SAT report.
Great. Awesome. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing. Right. And now we are... for the tentative agreement.
So this is the item for the tentative agreement between Santa Cruz City Schools and the SCCCE, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank both bargaining teams for their work to bring forward an agreement that worked for both the employees and for the district. The agreement is very similar to that of the salary component of the agreement is very similar to the teacher's agreement, just a flip in what year the 3% took place and what year the 2.5% one time took place. But I like to appreciate the amount of time that both teams put in, their effort to also tackle some difficult language, and reach some resolution on some language that I think is also going to help everyone in the long run with clarity around work here and other items. So thank you to both teams, and we would bring this agreement to you with a recommendation for approval.
Are there any questions from the board?
Just one comment. Chris, this is the item where you had at the very beginning of the meeting stated that all pieces will reflect the 3-8 date, correct?
Yes.
Yes, so I don't think the units are here, so if you might want to let them know so that they can know, because they came in a little late, what had happened on agenda.
So we made a correction on the agenda, and the original had a footer with one date on it, and the second one has, it's now two documents. The corrected document has a 3-8 date. We need to move the other pieces of it to also have a 3-8 date, so it's all one full document. We'll do that and send it out to everybody.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Comment from the public?
Yeah, I just want to let the board know that my members have already voted on
this. Would you like to come up to the podium?
Thank you. Anything for you. I just want to let you know that my members have already voted on this. We passed it overwhelmingly, and I want to thank Molly and her team. It was a long, drawn-out process. We learned a lot.
Do we have a motion?
I move
second.
That we approve this agreement.
Sheila and Patty, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. And 8.3.6.
The next is we have 5 confidential classified employees who we'd like to bring on to this agreement. So we gave an initial raise to them at the same time as we did certificated, reflecting a certificated agreement. There's a slight difference between the certificated agreement and the classified agreement, and this trues that group up to the rest of the classified employees in this agreement. So I move that we approve the adjustment of the confidential employees' salary schedule, and the reason that they aren't automatically with the bargaining unit is they're the only members of the classified team who are not in the bargaining unit.
Yes. Approval. Jeremy?
It flips the 3 and the 2.5.
Right.
No, she didn't make a motion. Yeah. She just stated the recommendation.
She did say
we're still on questions. Are there any questions from the board? Questions or comments from the public?
I would just encourage you to approve that confidential staff.
Robert, could you say that a little louder?
I said I would encourage you to approve that confidential staff of our brothers and sisters.
Okay. No further comments. Is there a motion?
Move approval.
And a second?
Second.
It's Patty and Dee Dee. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. 8.3.7.
Madam President, just to clarify,
yes.
This is actually the item where those revised salary schedules are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay, but I just wanted to be clear for the record.
Oh, the next item?
The next item. That's where the revisions were made on the salary schedules for the PERS eligible classified for 14-15 and 15-16, and then the addition of the licensed professional agreements.
Okay.
So this is where those footers were.
All right.
I apologize, Mayor.
No, that's okay, because we said it at the very beginning of the meeting, and I didn't catch it then. Everybody said 8.3.5, and I didn't click in when you guys said that, so forgive me.
Okay. Chris?
So I'd like to bring forward the revised salary schedules that reflect this agreement that we just voted on for your approval.
Are there any questions? Comments? Anything from the public? Do we have a motion?
I move approval.
Sheila?
Second.
Claudia? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. 8.3.8. Did I skip something? No.
So I bring forth to you to approve the DSCFT's sunshine items for 2016-2017.
Questions or comments from the board? Anything from the public? Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Dee Dee? And a second?
A second.
Claudia? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. And that's the last item. 8.3.9, Sunshine Santa Cruz City School to GSCFT.
So I also bring forward tonight Sunshine items from our district to the GSCFT.
Here we go.
I move.
Anything from anyone? Sheila so moves. Move. Come on. Let's have
I'll
a second. Claudia will second it. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. Okay, we are on 8.3.11. New business resolution 3515.
No, we skipped 10.
It was deleted.
It was deleted.
Oh, that's right.
Come on, guys. I know what I'm doing here. 8.3.11.
So I bring back to you a resolution of reduction of particular kinds of services. What you'll find is an updated of what we're looking at moving forward for 2016-17. Again, I'm hoping that we will not be needing to lay off all these positions, but as master schedules changed, enrollment has changed, as students are choosing classes and what they're gonna take, we were able to even make this more specific than I could last time. And again, we're really hoping to, you know, this will be as minimal as we possibly can make it.
Jeremy?
So this 7.0 FTE reduction, mm-hmm. one in art, three in English, one in PE, and two in Spanish, mm-hmm. represents the reduction over and above the temporary layoffs that we've already mm-hmm. dealt with.
Correct.
And my question is, obviously these layoffs are not equal across the board. For example, there's no layoff in, there's no reduction in social science or math, whereas we see three in English. Mm-hmm. Just looking at the English, why do we see so many in English as opposed to none in either science, math, or social science, for example?
Yeah, you need to talk about.
So when we're looking at the master schedules, we have to have more temporary teachers in a content area. We're reducing across the disciplines because we have fewer students in our high schools and our and so the reductions are happening across the disciplines. We're refining where that's happening as we were working on the master schedules, because part of it is part of what gets factored in is the number of kids that we end up having sign up and submit their paperwork and do that for new enrollees into the system. But there is reductions across. For example, we reduced 15 sections at Harbor High School, and you
right.
saw that in the FTE allocations
right.
that happened when we submitted staffing in January.
Mm-hmm.
So what you saw at the end of that line when we gave you the FTE allocations, you saw a reduction at each, at all three of our high schools
yeah.
had reductions,
yeah.
except for Soquel.
A quick follow-up,
mm-hmm.
I'm simply wondering, does this imply then, or yeah, is implicit in this 3.0 in English is the fact, I'm asking, is implicit in the 3.0 reduction in English is the fact that that English classes have come in historically at lower class sizes than, for example, math or social science?
What that means is we had fewer temporary teachers in English.
That's it.
We had fewer temporary teachers in English. We had more tenured teachers in English. And so... and
simple as that. Okay.
I agree.
Any other questions?
Sorry,
go ahead, Patty.
It's always PE for me when we get to this point, and I understand how complicated and how tight the funding is that these very little wiggle room. You say that except for Soquel High, does that mean that no PE is being cut at Soquel High?
There is no PE being cut, and I am hopeful that we will not have a PE reduction in the end.
And I will say that I have consistently for the last three times voted no to this because it is my belief that some of these areas don't have the opportunity to come back, that they are always usually filled with more of an A through G offering, knowing that we're trying to move the schedule. So I will be voting to approve this, but I do think that you take note that I always say the same thing in this manner.
Yeah.
I squeak for that because it's part of what I believe is a comprehensive education has lots of offerings for physical movement, just for physical movement sometimes.
What I can tell you too is this was, you know, we posted this a couple of days ago, and even since then, you know, my thanks to Desiree for combing through these master schedules and figuring all the pieces out. So I am hopeful that will actually be a non-reduction.
Thank you.
Sheila.
So, Molly, I just wanted to, every time I think I understand all of this, then something throws me again. So I was asking you about the advertisement for positions at Soquel, and you said Soquel was growing. Can you explain to me the relationship between Soquel growing and these cuts across all the schools?
Right, well, as Krisha said, we cut 15 sections at Harbor. So this is district-wide. So when we cut folks from Harbor, they have a right to English position.
Oh, so when we see those come up,
they could go into
their in-house.
We have to find a place for those folks before we hire anyone out or bring our temp folks back.
Okay.
And it's a really, really complex jigsaw puzzle at one school site when you're looking at putting a master school schedule together, and then when you take 10 school sites and all the staffing at 10 school sites, it's looking at seniority and rights and all kinds of things. It's a pretty complex puzzle.
Are there any comments from the public? Okay, the recommendation is to approve resolution.
So moved.
Dee Dee.
Second.
And second by Sheila. This is a roll call.
Aye.
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 And that's it.
That's it.
Yay! Dr. Lobson, could I ask your advice? So how should we have handled that? In terms of...